DH Audio presents That Summer Place. Two short stories by Debbie Maycomer and Susan Wiggs. Private Paradise by Debbie Maycomer. Read for you by Paula Parker. July, 1998.
Hey, Mom, this place is way cool.
Standing in front of the three-story summer home, with its elaborate gingerbread trim, Beth Graham had to agree. She set her suitcase down, still staring at Rain Shadow Lodge. A wide, welcoming porch wrapped its way around the front, and huge picture windows granted an unrestricted view of Puget Sound. The sun shimmered on the gentle waters lapping the shore. Mary Jane had been right. A month's vacation on Spruce Island was exactly what she needed.
"Can you imagine what a place like this rents for?"
Paul said in awe. More than they ever could have afforded on their own, that was for sure. It really was a lovely house, and just knowing she'd be able to enjoy the luxury of this island paradise for the next 31 days made Beth feel almost lighthearted. Better yet, she'd be sharing it with her longtime friend, Mary Jane Reynolds. All thanks to Schumacher & Company, a consulting firm based in Southern California. Schumacher had actually rented the house, not for Beth and her son, but for Dave Reynolds and his family. Mary Jane was the one who'd invited Beth to join them while Dave did consulting work for Boeing, the airplane manufacturing company. Beth had leapt at the chance to escape St. Louis in July. Leapt at the chance to escape, period. The past 2 years had been difficult ones, as she adjusted to widowhood and being a single mother. She knew it was time to pick up the threads of her life. Time to resume her catering career and get back into the swing of a daily routine. It was past time, really, or so her friends had said. Beth couldn't understand that attitude. She didn't know where it was written that a woman had 6 months or 12 or whatever preordained number of months to recover from the death of a loved one. Some of her friends, although Mary Jane wasn't among them, seemed to imply that her allotted time for grieving had now expired. Life wasn't quite that simple in Beth's experience. But, ready or not, she'd decided to return to work in September. She'd accepted a good position with a 5-star hotel and had agreed to start right after Labor Day, which meant she had all of July and August to spend with her 15-year-old son, plus this whole month with Mary Jane. The summer would be a transition between what remained of her old life and her new one.
"When will they get here?" Paul asked.
He knew that as well as she did. They'd gone over the details 100 times in the past 24 hours. Mary Jane, Dave, and their 3 teenage boys would arrive after Beth and Paul at around 7 that evening. The months of planning and the countless phone calls would all pay off, and the fun would begin.
7 o'clock, right?
Paul answered his own question. He reached for his suitcase and one of hers. She nodded solemnly, observing, not for the first time, how much her son had matured in the past couple of years. Good heavens, he'd gotten his learner's permit the week before they left and would start a driving course in September. That alone seemed unbelievable. Since Jim's death, Paul had taken on quite a few household chores. But more than that, he seemed to want to protect her, to shield her emotions, perhaps, and fill the hole Jim's passing had left in her life. It was because of Paul that Beth had agreed to return to work, to give the impression that she'd recovered from her husband's death. For Paul's sake more than her own. He'd taken his father's death hard and rarely spoke of him. Beth suspected it was too painful even now. With a dramatic flourish, Paul inserted the key into the lock and threw open the front door. The summer house was impressive from the outside, But little could have prepared Beth for the charm that awaited her when she stepped over the threshold. The hardwood entry brought them to a living room filled with large, overstuffed chairs and a sofa. There was a stone fireplace against one wall. A sweeping staircase led to the second floor. Paul carried their bags up the stairs, eager to explore the bedrooms, while Beth headed for the kitchen. She wasn't disappointed. The big, bright country kitchen had a cooking island, more than adequate counter space, and all the modern appliances, including an espresso machine and a second oven. Only a woman who loved to cook as much as Beth did would appreciate the convenience of two ovens.
"Mom!" Paul shouted from halfway down the stairs. "I counted 6 bedrooms!"
6? The brochure Mary Jane had mailed her said 5.
"All right, 5 in a television room. One of the bedrooms is on the 3rd floor. There's a jacuzzi, too. Oh, and there's a library, too, off the living room. It's got a huge fireplace and big double doors that slide open. You'll love it."
Beth could see herself quickly falling in love with this house. Eager to explore the rest of it, Paul raced down both sets of stairs. He reached the bottom just as the telephone rang.
"I'll get it,"
he yelled, grabbing the receiver.
"Hi, Mary Jane."
He turned to look at Beth and then handed her the phone.
"Where are you?"
Beth asked, hoping it was the airport, and somehow knowing it wasn't. The laughter and excitement that had filled the air only seconds earlier evaporated with the knowledge that something had gone wrong.
"Beth," Mary Jane said urgently, "I'm so sorry."
"Sorry?"
"I've been trying to reach you since late yesterday afternoon."
"We spent the night with my mother-in-law. She lives close to the airport. What's wrong?"
"It's Dave. He fell off the roof yesterday while he was trying to fix the skylight."
"Is he all right?"
"Yes, and no. He broke his leg in 2 places. He was in surgery for 3 hours this morning, and he's still too groggy to understand what's happening. But he's doing much better than we expected."
"Is she coming?"
Paul mouthed.
Beth shrugged, unable to answer.
With luck, they'd only be delayed a few days. "Dave's going to be in the hospital in traction for the next week or so."
The hope that had briefly flared to life died a quick and sudden death. After months of planning, of excited anticipation, Mary Jane wouldn't be coming.
"The company's sending another consultant."
"Oh." It went without saying that this new consultant wasn't ready to share the house with Dave Reynolds' wife's best friend from high school and her 15-year-old son.
"His name's John Livingstone. Dr. John Livingstone."
"How long do we have?" Beth asked, hoping they could at least spend the night.
"Have?"
"Before John and his family arrive."
"There's only him and his daughter. He's divorced."
Not that his marital status had anything to do with the problem at hand.
"You might strike up some kind of arrangement with him," her friend went on.
"What kind of arrangement?"
"John's a reasonable man."
"I'm sure he is."
"He wasn't expecting to fly up to Seattle, and he's got a 12-year-old daughter who isn't keen to come with him. I don't know much about him other than he's brilliant."
Beth's mind was working fast. If Dr. John Livingstone let them spend tonight here, surely she could find something else tomorrow. Surely there was some cheap place they could rent for a week or two. If she watched her pennies, there might be a way for her and Paul to stay in the area after all.
"I can't remember the girl's name, but I do recall that he's got custody of her. You'd be great with her, a positive female influence. Besides that, John's nice looking."
"What's that got to do with anything?"
"Not a single thing. It's just that..."
Beth could almost see her friend's mind working.
"Just what?"
"It seems to me that you're both adults, and you could come up with a compromise."
"Such as?"
"Sharing the house. You were our class valedictorian. You figure it out." While Beth had all the book smarts she'd ever needed in life, that hardly qualified her to deal with a situation like this. Sharing a house with a stranger? A man?
No, it couldn't be done. Beth didn't get the opportunity to tell Mary Jane that her idea was out of the question. The words died on her lips at the sound of the front door opening. "When's this John Livingstone supposed to arrive?" Beth asked, whirling around as though to confront an assailant. "He's due any time." "I think he's here now. I'll call you back later." She set the phone in its cradle, placed her hand on Paul's shoulder, and prepared to confront Dave Reynolds' replacement. "Just let us stay here tonight," she breathed. "Please, just tonight." The daughter entered the house first, and one look at her dashed all Beth's hopes. She might be 12, but she looked much older. The ends of her hair were green, and everything else was black, including her lips and her fingernails. She had on a black T-shirt, black jeans, and a black backpack. "Who are you?" the girl demanded, glaring at Beth. The man who stepped in after her looked tired and irritated. Beth forced herself to smile and stepped forward to offer her hand. "Dr. Livingstone, I presume." "Just exactly who are you?" Nikki narrowed her eyes at the woman and the boy, as if she worked for the FBI. "Nikki," John muttered, "I'll ask the questions." This wasn't his day, or his month, or his year, for that matter. He looked at the woman and asked, "Just exactly who are you?" "I'm Beth Graham, and this is my son Paul. We're friends of the Reynolds family." "Ah. Perhaps I could put on a pot of coffee, and we could talk this out. We just arrived ourselves, and... oh, dear, this is something of a mess." "You were planning to share the house with Dave Reynolds and his family?" John thought the situation was becoming far too complicated. He'd gotten a call around 8 the night before from the company president, who'd asked him to fill in on this assignment. John had agreed, but really, what choice did he have when it was coming from Schumacher himself? Then there was Nikki, who made spending a month away from her friends sound as if he was dragging her off to boot camp. Now this. "They aren't staying here, are they, Dad?" If it was up to his daughter, she'd throw them out in their ear without giving the matter a second thought. He found himself annoyed with her lack of patience, her lack of compassion. Then again, if he was going to complain about Nikki's failings, he should look to his own. He'd been a rotten husband, and now it seemed he wasn't much of a father. "Yes, why don't we all sit down and talk this out?" John said, wondering just how uncomfortable this was likely to get. The four of them moved into the kitchen, and Nikki threw herself into a seat at the breakfast nook, as if sitting down in a civilized manner required too much effort. Paul slipped in across from her, and the two eyed each other warily. As Beth made coffee, she explained the situation. "Mary Jane and I are friends from high school. Mary Jane is Dave's wife?" Beth nodded. When Mary Jane learned Dave would be spending a month in Seattle, she researched rental houses and found this one. It was cheaper to rent Rain Shadow Lodge than for Dave to stay alone in a hotel room for the month. Seeing that there are 5 bedrooms, she asked Paul and me to join them. "We've been planning it since last March," Paul added, his voice betraying his disappointment. "It's the first time we've gotten away since my dad died." John watched as Beth gave her son a gentle look that said she'd do the explaining. "But, Mom, he needs to know how much we've been looking forward to this. I must have read 5 books about Seattle and the San Juans and..." "Paul, please." "It's really a big house," her son said. "They wouldn't even know we were here." He turned to John. "We've got trips planned for practically every day, and Mom signed us up for kayaking lessons this week, and then there's a trip to Victoria, British Columbia. I've never been to Canada, and..." John watched as Beth's cheeks flushed pink. Clearly her son's outburst had embarrassed her. She was around his own age, he guessed, and attractive. The realization caught him by surprise. It had been a long while since he thought of a woman in those terms. For the past 3 years, he'd done his best to ignore the opposite sex altogether. His own wife had left him for a man she'd met on the Internet. Even now, Just thinking about Lorraine and her cyberspace boyfriend tightened his jaw. The fact that she'd actually divorce him for a man she'd never met face to face had deeply scored his pride. But apparently, it was a match made in cyber heaven, because the two of them appeared blissfully content. Within a month of exchanging their first email messages, Lorraine had left her husband and daughter, lover boy didn't like kids, and moved to Philadelphia. Once the divorce was final, Lorraine had remarried within a week. "My mom's a really wonderful cook, and she could fix all the meals." "Paul!" She cast John an apologetic look. "I'm sorry. Paul's disappointed, and, well, I can see it'd be best if we found other accommodations." The teenager wasn't the only one who felt disappointed, John suspected. Beth's shoulders sagged slightly, and the luster was gone from her eyes. This was one hell of a predicament. "Is there someplace else you can stay?" John immediately wanted to grab back the question. He already knew the answer. He'd been told that the island's population doubled in the summer months. A drive-through town hadn't revealed a single vacancy sign.
"I'm sure there is,"
she reassured him with a smile. "We'll call for a taxi and be out of your hair within the hour." "Hold on." John sighed and buried his hands in his pants pockets. There was only one decent thing to do, not that he liked it. He didn't, no way. But he couldn't see any other alternative. Paul's eyes widened with gratitude.
"You mean we can stay?"
John hesitated. All he'd intended to offer was the night.
"You won't be sorry," the boy insisted. "We can earn our keep. Mom can cook, and I'll clean up around the place, mow the lawn, and..."
"Paul," Beth said, raising her voice slightly, "I think it'd be best if Dr. Livingstone and I discussed this privately." Her son accepted her words with good grace, turned to Nikki and said, "You want to see the upstairs?"
"Sure,"
Nikki replied, showing the first signs of life since they'd arrived. The two kids left the room, and Beth waited until they were out of earshot.
"I am so sorry."
She handed him a mug of freshly brewed coffee.
"Sorry?"
"Paul makes it sound like we're desperate."
"You cook?"
He walked to the table and claimed a chair, and she sat down on the bench. "I'm a caterer, or I was, until 2 years ago. I quit work after my husband was killed. But I have a job now, or I will, starting in September." John took a restorative sip of coffee while he mulled things over. It boded well that Nikki and Paul seemed to get along, although it was too early to know for sure. He'd never been comfortable with the idea of leaving his daughter alone every day while he went to work. He'd be taking the new direct-to-Seattle ferry, which meant an hour's commute each way. Then there was all the time he'd actually be spending in the city.
"Listen," Beth smiled brightly, "this has been a shock, but once Paul and I get our bearings, we'll be out of your hair. I apologize for any inconvenience we might have caused you."
John stared into the dark, rich coffee before he spoke. "Let's not be hasty. Perhaps we can work something out after all." This had to be the worst summer of her life, Nikki thought, sitting on the porch steps after dinner, which she'd barely touched. She was stuck here with Martha Stewart and the boy Wonder, because her dad was going to desert her every morning. It hadn't taken long, she thought darkly, for the intruders to sucker her dad into letting them stay, all in exchange for cooking meals and babysitting services. Nikki couldn't believe her dad had actually agreed to this. What bothered her most was his saying this was for her benefit. Yeah, right. She didn't want company, and the last thing she cared about was seeing the sights. Nikki didn't know what her father was thinking. The last thing she wanted, or needed, was a babysitter. As for Beth seeing to their meals, big deal. Up until now, her dad had been eating the dinners she made without complaining. The screen door creaked behind her, but Nikki didn't turn around to see who it was. She already knew. Her dad sat down on the step next to her. "Tired?"
"No."
"You don't look very happy."
"Give the man a prize."
It isn't my fault Dave Reynolds broke his leg.
That's not the point. She manipulated you into letting her live here rent-free, and I'm supposed to be happy?
You think I should have kicked her out?
Damn straight I do. We don't need her.
Her dad didn't say anything for a couple of minutes. You're right. We don't need her.
Then why'd you let her stay?
She needs us.
Oh, please!
There's no vacancies on the island.
How do you know that?
Don't you remember what the ticket agent said when I mentioned Spruce Island? Nikki didn't. He said it was one of the most popular of the San Juans. Spruce Island is a great summer escape. You didn't notice any vacancy signs while we were driving in, did you? She shrugged. Truth be known, she hadn't looked.
I don't need a babysitter.
Her vehemence surprised even her. Of course you don't.
Then why?
I suggested Beth include you in their plans, so she'd think she was earning her keep. People have their pride, you know.
So I can do what I want, right?
He hesitated. Right, but... Nikki groaned.
There's always a but.
You can do what you want, but it has to be within reason.
This is going to be a real fun month, she said sarcastically.
Then she heard someone move up behind her. She twisted around and glared over her shoulder. Sure enough, Beth Graham stood on the other side of the screen door, watching them.
What are you doing sneaking up on my dad and me?
Nikki shouted, vaulting to her feet.
Let's get something straight right now. My dad said you could live here, but I don't have to like it. Just because you...
I'm sorry, I...
That's enough, Nikki.
It was her dad's tone of voice that stopped her. When he was annoyed, he raised his voice. But when he was angry, really angry with her, he kept it level. Only someone who knew him as well as she did would realize that. I apologize for intruding, Beth said softly. Nikki crossed her arms and rolled her eyes. I wanted to tell you I was going up to bed and tell Nikki I'd see her in the morning. Nikki couldn't contain a snicker. See her in the morning. Not if she had anything to say about it. Tired though she was, Beth barely slept that first night. It wasn't the bed or even the circumstances. Well, that was part of the problem. But what seemed strangest of all was the silence. She lay awake half the night straining to hear something, anything. She wasn't accustomed to the lack of sound and found it downright eerie. When the sun rose, it was so bright it woke her. She opened one eye and looked at the clock, shocked to discover it was only 5:45. The sun, however, refused to go away. Actually, she had to admit this was a pleasant way to wake, and she sat up in the feather bed, stretched her arms, and yawned. Beth reached for her robe and headed down the stairs. Not wanting to wake anyone else, she made as little sound as possible. Her plans were to brew a pot of coffee and take a mug outside to the porch swing. Enjoy the luxury of early morning. She was halfway into the kitchen before she realized John was up and dressed. He sat at the table in a business suit, reading the Seattle morning paper.
Oh,
she said before she could stop herself. He lowered the newspaper and frowned. Morning.
Good morning. I didn't realize anyone was up.
Since she'd slept so lightly, it surprised her that she hadn't heard him. There's coffee. He gestured toward the pot.
You're going into work? So early?
She regretted the question as soon as she'd asked. I'll be back late this afternoon.
Would you care for breakfast?
Nothing, thanks. His gaze didn't waver from the newspaper. He seemed to resent her intrusion.
Have a good day, then,
she said, pouring herself a cup of coffee. She was almost out of the kitchen when he stopped her. I'll leave a phone number where I can be reached if you need to get a hold of me.
Thanks.
But she stayed where she was, suspecting he intended to say something else. About Nikki. She's got a chip on her shoulder about all of this. You might have noticed.
I did.
My daughter hasn't adjusted very well to the divorce. I'll be patient with her. I won't force her into anything she doesn't want to do.
His eyes revealed his gratitude.
She's a little difficult.
Teenagers can be. Then, because there didn't seem to be anything left to say, she carried her coffee outside. The morning was lovely beyond description. Beth sat on the porch swing and gazed out over Puget Sound. The screen door opened and Beth turned, expecting John. Instead, it was Paul.
What are you doing up so early?
He rubbed both eyes with his fists and sat down on the porch step.
I woke up and it was morning.
He sounded none too pleased by the discovery.
Well, what would you like to do today?
Beth figured he'd reel off a list of suggestions.
You know what I think, Mom?
You have to tell me, since my mind-reading skills aren't up to par these days.
He grinned.
I think we should spend the day getting to know Nikki. She isn't so bad, you know,
if you give her a chance.
Paul and I are going to explore the island, Beth told Nikki when the girl wandered downstairs shortly after 10 o'clock. She wore bulky coveralls and combat boots, and her green-tinted hair was pulled away from her face in a spiky ponytail.
Would you like to come?
Nikki tossed her a defiant look.
Not on your life. We found a tandem and a couple of old bikes in the carriage house, Paul said with unbounded enthusiasm.
Nikki made a couple of lazy circles with her index finger.
Yippee-skippy.
Would you like some breakfast before we go?
Beth wished she knew how to reach this child.
I'll fix my own breakfast, Nikki muttered, heading for the kitchen. If there's anything to eat in this place.
She cast a disparaging look around.
If I want salmon for dinner, I'll probably have to catch it myself.
Beth felt completely inadequate in dealing with this kid.
Sure you don't want to come?
Paul asked.
Positive.
Nikki dumped cereal in a bowl, then hid behind the refrigerator door as she rummaged for the milk.
Come on, Mom, Paul said. I'll meet you outside.
Beth badly wanted to make peace, but she could see it wasn't going to be easy. Nikki had no incentive.
I don't know how long we'll be, Beth told her as she walked toward the kitchen door.
Probably not long.
Yeah, whatever.
Would you like me to pick something up for you while I'm in town?
Yeah, would you?
Beth brightened. This was her first opportunity to prove she wasn't the enemy.
Sure. What do you need? How about a new life?
Oh, Nikki. Beth stepped toward her, aching to give her a hug. She might have followed the impulse if Nikki hadn't read her intention, stiffened, and abruptly spun around.
Mom!
Paul called impatiently from the yard.
Come on, let's go!
He had the tandem out of the garage and was obviously excited about trying it out.
We won't be long, Beth said again as she headed out the door.
Paul frowned when he saw her.
Just leave Nikki alone for now.
I wish she'd come.
Why?
She'd go out of her way to make us both miserable.
Give her time. She'll come around. He hopped onto the front of the bicycle, as if it was understood that he should be the driver. Beth had never ridden on a tandem before and wasn't convinced it was such a good idea. Paul stood astride the bike while she climbed on.
You ready?
He glanced over his shoulder.
I don't know.
Now that she was actually in the seat, she knew this was a mistake.
Here we go.
Before she realized it, the bike was in motion. It wobbled a couple of times before Paul's feet pumped the pedals, but then they were moving. Well, sort of moving.
Mom! Are you helping?
Hard as Beth tried, her feet kept missing the pedals.
Not yet.
Paul strained to carry both of them up the short incline in the driveway. Beth couldn't help it. She found herself giggling. The bike swayed, and before either of them could react, it toppled onto its side. Luckily, the grass cushioned their landing. Beth lay there for a moment, stunned, and then she started to laugh.
Really laugh. What a sight they must have made.
Mom, this isn't funny,
Paul said, but she could tell from his voice that he was smiling. Soon they were both sitting up on the lawn, laughing, until Beth thought they'd never stop. Paul helped her back to her feet, and as she stood, Beth caught a flash of green. Sure enough, Nikki was staring at them from the window above the kitchen sink. It was the first time she'd seen the girl smile, and the transformation was miraculous.
"You aren't giving up, are you?" Paul asked. "Are you kidding?"
Beth made a face at him.
"I was just beginning to get the hang of this."
There were other things she was beginning to understand as well. John arrived back at Rain Shadow Lodge at 4 o'clock. To his surprise, the house was empty. The back door was open, and the screen unlatched when he entered the kitchen. A salmon fillet was marinating on the island inside a glass baking dish covered with clear wrap.
"Nikki?"
His daughter didn't respond. Setting aside his briefcase, he worked his tie loose and wandered into the living room.
"Nikki?"
He noticed the front door was wide open. No one with a shred of self-preservation even left a door unlocked in California. He stepped onto the porch and saw his daughter sitting on a large rock that overlooked the beach.
"There you are."
He walked toward her.
"Hi, Dad."
She smiled at him. He wasn't accustomed to a warm greeting from her.
"What did you do today?"
"Nothing. I thought Beth and Paul were riding bikes into town."
"They did."
"You didn't join them?" She rolled her eyes, implying that was a stupid question.
"No way."
He wondered at her mood, which seemed to have improved vastly in the time he'd been away.
"Where are Beth and Paul now?"
"There." She pointed toward the beach. His gaze followed her gesture, and he found mother and son walking along the beach side by side. The tide was out, and they appeared to be beachcombing, stopping now and then to lean over and examine something the tide had left behind. Then he heard Beth laugh. It had been so long since he'd heard a woman laugh with such sheer pleasure that the sound took him aback for a moment, almost as though he had to identify its source. John almost laughed, too. Watching Beth with her son had affected him the same way it had Nikki. That was what her small, tentative smile had been about.
"Did you know Paul has his driver's permit?"
Nikki commented as though she found it hard to believe.
"He's 15.
John's only response was to arch his eyebrows. He wasn't sure if Nikki's tone meant the boy was that old or that young.
"Boys don't mature as fast as girls," she said, sounding like an expert on the subject of child development.
"Is that right?" he said, playing along. It was unusual to have a conversation with Nikki for more than a few minutes without some kind of conflict arising. He envied the camaraderie between Beth and her son.
"I don't think Paul's going to be much of a driver," Nikki said.
"What makes you say that?"
"You should have seen him and his mom on the tandem. I'm telling you, Dad, it was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. I laughed so hard I had to hold my stomach."
She relayed the scene for him, and John soon found himself grinning. "Did they pick up the salmon while they were in town?"
"Yeah."
"Did you ask her to?"
"Nope."
Salmon was his daughter's favorite dinner. She'd eat it 7 nights a week if she could. If she had made some remark, it was considerate of Beth to notice. Beth and Paul turned back toward the house and must have seen him and Nikki. With a smile as bright as a lighthouse beam, Beth raised her free hand above her head and waved. Even from this distance, John was warmed by her welcome.
"At least come down to the dock with us," Paul urged Nikki the morning of their scheduled kayaking lesson.
The first few days with Nikki had been rough, but Beth soon realized her most powerful ally was her own son. When Paul did the inviting, the chance that Nikki would tag along immediately increased. She'd joined them for a couple of outings. And while she laughed and goofed around with Paul, she kept a protective distance from Beth.
"I'm not getting inside any boat that rolls over in the water," Nikki protested. "The least you can do is come down to the dock with us," Paul said. "It's better than sitting around the house all day by yourself."
Nikki hesitated.
"Oh, all right."
But don't expect me to change my mind.
Nikki raced upstairs and returned in shorts and tennis shoes, black, of course, with a backpack slung over one shoulder. Once she was ready, they headed toward the carriage house for the bicycles. Up to this point, Beth had ridden on the tandem with Paul, but she'd seen Nikki glance enviously at the two of them. Nikki, would you mind riding the tandem with Paul? I don't seem to be able to get the knack of it, and, well, frankly, I'm a bit afraid to try again. I'll take one of the regular bikes. Beth wondered briefly if Nikki had seen through her ploy. If so, the girl chose to overlook it.
Yeah, sure, Nikki said.
For just an instant, Beth thought she might have seen the girl smile. It astonished her how gratified an almost smile made her feel. While no longer openly hostile, Nikki wasn't exactly friendly either. But thanks to Paul, Beth felt she was making progress, bit by bit, day by day. As soon as they got down to the dock and met their instructor, Nikki decided, with a little persuasion from Paul, to try kayaking herself. Beth's reaction to the girl's change in attitude was a blend of relief and unreserved delight. So what if she couldn't expect that change to last? Needless to say, Nikki grumbled and complained until she was in the water and paddling on her own. A smile teetered on her lips, then gave way to a full-blown laugh as the three of them practiced maneuvers in the protected waters of the marina. Later on, high from their adventurous morning, they rode home. When they biked into the yard, Beth noticed John's car parked in the carriage house. Nikki couldn't get off the tandem fast enough.
"Dad! Dad!"
she shouted as she ran toward the house. John must have been standing at the kitchen window, because the next thing Beth knew, he was on the back porch.
"I saw an eagle!"
Nikki called out to him, breathless with excitement.
"I mean, I really saw an eagle!"
"I thought it was going to claw me," Paul said, and shaped both hands into giant hooks. He dove at Nikki, who ducked and raced to her father's side.
Laughing, Nikki glanced at Beth.
"You should have seen Beth. She screamed for us to cover our heads and..."
John frowned.
"Perhaps you'd better start from the beginning."
"We were kayaking."
"You went kayaking?" John asked, his look incredulous. He glanced to Beth for confirmation. She nodded.
"We were about 100 yards off the island when an eagle started circling overhead. Paul pointed him out, and it was as if the bird saw him because he swooped down to the water with his claws open. But he wasn't after us. He dipped his claws in the water and grabbed a fish, Dad. It was so close I saw the gills of the fish move."
John's smile widened. "That must have been an incredible sight."
"The most awesome experience of my entire life," Nikki said solemnly, pushing her way into the kitchen. "I need something to drink. Anyone else want lemonade?"
"Me,"
Paul called and hurried in after her. John remained on the porch with Beth. Their eyes met for the briefest of moments. Then she glanced away. Feeling the need to say something, she brushed back her bangs with one hand and said, "We had a great time."
"So it seems."
"Here!"
Nikki shoved open the door from the kitchen. She thrust a tall glass of lemonade into Beth's hand.
"I'm glad I went kayaking," she whispered.
"I'm glad you did, too."
"But it doesn't mean anything," she said, as if warning her not to expect more.
"I wouldn't think of assuming that it did," Beth said. It really was beautiful here, John had to admit. The water was a deep blue-green. The surrounding fir trees had a delightfully pungent scent. The air, which retained the day's warmth, was fresh and clean. He sighed with complete satisfaction as he stood on the front porch, hands in his pockets. Beth sat in a wicker chair no more than 5 feet from him. He'd been wanting to talk to her for some time now, to thank her for the subtle softening he saw in his daughter. But he felt awkward and wasn't sure how to go about it. This had been his problem with his ex-wife Lorraine as well. He could analyze a business's computer system, see its mistakes, and offer suggestions on how to correct them. but he couldn't seem to apply those same analytical skills to his own life. Somehow, words just got in the way.
"It's a lovely evening, isn't it?" Beth asked.
John nodded, grateful she'd taken the initiative in starting the conversation.
"I didn't expect it to be this beautiful here. I've always pictured the Seattle area as having lots of rain, fog, gloom, that sort of thing. But you know what? The weather doesn't surprise me as much as Nikki and Paul volunteering to put the dishes in the dishwasher. That really was very sweet."
John sat down in the empty chair beside her. "Well, it was fair exchange after that wonderful dinner."
The halibut had been simply prepared, broiled and served with fluffy rice and crisp green beans. There'd been a salad, too, and a strawberry pie for dessert. One thing about living in Rain Shadow Lodge, these were the best meals he and Nikki had eaten in years.
"This compromise of ours is working out rather well," he said, "better than he'd ever imagined." Like Nikki, his attitude hadn't been the greatest when he'd discovered he'd be sharing the house with a school chum of Mary Jane Reynolds. Yet within a week, Beth and Paul had influenced Nikki's attitude for the better. He felt confident that it wouldn't be long before Nikki was her old self again, laughing, running, being a kid.
"If I haven't told you before, thank you for letting us stay."
Beth's voice was low and mellow, as though she was half asleep. John was sure she had no idea how sensual she sounded. "This afternoon," he hesitated, finding it difficult to speak because of the emotion crowding his heart. "I can't remember Nikki ever being that excited about anything."
"Well, you have to admit, it was a pretty incredible sight."
"Oh, John, I wish you'd been there. The entire afternoon was fantastic. I'm so grateful to be here, to experience this. I'm enjoying my vacation more than I expected."
"Mom!" Paul burst onto the porch, Nikki at his heels. "Can we have a fire on the beach tonight?"
Beth glanced at John.
"Why not?"
John asked lightly. If ever he'd had a reason to celebrate, he did today. His daughter was happy, and just hearing her laugh again was cause enough.
"Come on," Nikki said to Paul. "Let's go collect the wood."
She leapt off the top step and raced toward the beach with Paul right behind. The two of them ran along the shoreline, shouting instructions at each other. The silence seemed even louder once the children had come and gone.
"I haven't been much of a father," he confessed.
"Oh, John, that's what every parent believes.
But you, I suffer my own doubts." "Paul didn't dye his hair green."
"No, but he sucked his thumb until he was 6. It's obvious how much you love Nikki.
And really, that's all she needs. All any child needs." Hearing her tell him that was just the balm his heart craved. Gratitude filled him, but he could think of no way to tell her how he felt. He stood.
"You ready for this fire?" She groaned. "If you had any idea how sore I am after today, you'd never have agreed to this."
She placed her hand in his and let him pull her to her feet. They stood, with only a few inches separating them. In any other circumstances, John would have stepped back, but neither of them moved. Their eyes met, and he studied her, looking for some indication of what she was thinking, what she was feeling. He read the question on her face and knew it was a reflection of his own doubts. He hadn't kissed another woman since Lorraine, hadn't even been tempted. But he was now. More than he'd dreamed possible. It required every ounce of restraint he possessed not to ease her into his arms and taste her lips. The need pulsed through him. Something was happening. His heart pounded like a teenager's, an odd staccato that echoed in his ears. He cleared his throat.
"I guess we'd better see how the kids are doing."
She nodded and lowered her gaze.
"I'll put my cup in the kitchen and join you in a couple of minutes."
Sure.
As she entered the house, John exhaled a deep breath while he tried to reason out what had just happened.
Dad!
Nikki shouted, running up from the beach. She stopped short of the house and stared at him.
What?
He was certain that his attraction to Beth showed in his face.
Are you all right?
Nikki gave him an odd look.
Of course I'm all right,
he snapped, and then instantly apologized. Nikki readily forgave him.
We're going to need matches.
I'll take care of it,
he told her.
But as far as he was concerned, he didn't need anything to light a fire. A lovely widow had already set one under him.
Troubled, Nikki returned to the beach and sank onto a log.
What's wrong?
Paul asked.
My dad,
she muttered, not sure how she felt just yet. Seeing him like this had come as a shock.
I'm afraid he's got the hots for your mom.
He's got what?
The hots. You should have seen him just now. He looked like he was about to throw up, and then he snapped at me.
What's wrong with him liking my mom?
I didn't say there was anything wrong, but...
She was confused about this situation. Definitely confused. Beth was all right, Nikki decided. Actually, she was a lot of fun. Spending time with Beth and Paul while her dad went into Seattle every day had turned out a whole lot better than she'd imagined.
But what?
My mother was a real ditz, she said, wanting him to understand.
Your parents are divorced, right?
Right.
My mom ran off with another man.
I saw it happen.
I mean, she was always on the computer sending this weird guy email messages. My dad didn't have a clue what was going on. He just couldn't believe it when she told him she was leaving.
My mom didn't know either,
Paul murmured, lowering himself onto the beach beside her. He hung his head, and his voice dipped so low she had trouble hearing him.
This story is continued on the other side of the cassette.
Your dad died.
He did, but he had a girlfriend. He didn't think I knew, but I did.
Your mom didn't know?
Of course not. She never even suspected. She really, really loved my dad. When we found out he'd been killed, I thought my mom was going to die herself, just from the way she was afterward. It wasn't like she cried or carried on all the time, but he wasn't the same.
Even now. He let his words fade as he became involved in his thoughts.
How'd he die? Car accident?
He was a contractor, and a bunch of bricks fell on him.
Nikki gave an involuntary grimace.
Don't you want your dad to remarry? Paul asked, studying her.
Nikki didn't. Not when he'd been so hurt by one woman, even if that woman happened to be her own mother. But before she could tell him, Paul continued,
I don't want my mom to be alone, especially after I leave for college.
But don't you worry about the man she might marry? He could turn out just like your dad, with a girlfriend on the side.
This time will be different.
How do you mean?
Because I'm here to help her decide. I won't let her marry someone like my dad. A new husband would have to pass my scrutiny.
Same with me.
My mom's going to need help, though.
Help?
Well, just look at her. She isn't even trying to meet anyone. It's been 2 years, and her friends are all telling her to date again, but she won't listen.
My dad doesn't date much either. If my dad did remarry...
Yeah?
I'd want him to choose someone like your mother.
Once she'd said the words, she realized how much she really did like Beth. She hadn't wanted to. It just sort of happened, one day at a time.
I like your dad, Paul murmured, his face a study in concentration.
Think about it, Nikki. My mom and your dad.
Do you really think they might get together?
With a little help, like I already said.
We've got 3 weeks to make it happen.
Still grinning, Paul stuck out his palm, and she slapped it with hers. All of a sudden, this vacation held lots of promise. The small fire on the beach crackled and snapped. Beth sat in the sand between Paul and Nikki. John sat on his daughter's other side, and they sang boisterous camp songs. Beth liked the sound of John's voice, which was surprisingly deep. She found it almost impossible not to turn in his direction and stare at him. Something had happened between them earlier, but she was hard-pressed to say exactly what. She thought he'd been about to kiss her. He hadn't, but she wondered how she would have reacted if he had. She recalled how quiet he'd grown and how their eyes had met. Her heart had started beating hard and seemed to want to pulse its way out of her chest. When the song ended, they sat silently around the fire. Beth drew her knees up under her chin and gazed at the stars that sparkled and winked. "I invited Nikki and her dad to visit the rainforest with us tomorrow," Paul informed her. "'Cause it's Saturday." "Good idea," she said, not giving his suggestion a second thought, until she saw Nikki and Paul exchange a knowing look. Those two were up to something. She just wasn't sure what, and she didn't like the suspicions that quickly presented themselves.
"I'm tired,"
Nikki announced and made a show of stretching her arms high above her head and yawning loudly.
"Me too."
Paul mimicked her actions, releasing an exaggerated yawn, then leaping to his feet.
"We have a big day tomorrow. Come on, Nikki. I think we should make an early night of it."
"I don't think I can hold my head up much longer," Nikki added,
as though stumbling the great distance to the house was beyond her limited endurance. Before Beth could so much as wish them good night, the kids had disappeared.
"They couldn't have been any more obvious, could they?" John asked, a smile in his voice. "I think they have plans for us."
"I think so." She was embarrassed that Paul would agree to this blatant form of matchmaking. "I apologize, John. I don't know what got into my son. He knows better."
"Your son and my daughter have got to be the world's worst matchmakers," he said.
He moved to lean back against a log the size of a telephone pole that had washed onto the beach.
"Although I have to admit, I'm kind of touched they'd come up with such an idea."
"It is sweet, but..." She faltered, wishing he'd fill in the blanks.
"But?"
he pressed. "Well, it's rather embarrassing. I have no intention of becoming involved in another relationship, and I don't appreciate having two children attempt to manipulate my life. I'm sure you feel the same way." He smiled and said nothing. "What about you?" she asked, when she could stand the silence no longer. Have you considered remarrying?"
"Hardly."
"Me neither." Her voice grew strong with the strength of her conviction. "Anyway, what else could she say? Certainly not that she found him attractive, especially when he'd just made sure she understood he wasn't interested in a relationship any more than she was." She liked John. There was a great deal to like. But he wasn't interested, and neither was she. No, there was really nothing else to say. The silence stretched between them. Finally, John said, "You must have loved him very much."
"I did love my husband," she whispered.
Then, rather than endure any more of this uncomfortable conversation, she hurriedly stood and brushed the sand from her backside. "Shall we put out the fire?" "It's a shame to let it go to waste, don't you think? Stay a while. Enjoy the night with me." Beth couldn't believe the way her heart reacted to his request. Slowly, she sank back onto the sand. She wasn't sure which of them moved closer, but before she knew how it happened, they were sitting side by side. They listened to the sound of the waves gently stroking the beach for a few moments before John spoke again.
"You don't really think they've gone upstairs to bed, do you?"
"I couldn't say."
"My guess is they've got a pair of binoculars and they're watching us from the porch."
"They wouldn't dare."
Would they?
Although she asked the question, she knew there was every likelihood he was right.
What should we do about this?
Like John said, this matchmaking nonsense was flattering and rather sweet, but unchecked, it could become downright troublesome.
Do? He echoed.
I think we should give them something worth seeing. And with that, he wrapped his arm around her shoulders and bent his head toward hers. There was ample time to resist. But for the life of her, Beth couldn't deny herself his kiss.
Come on, Mom!
Paul called, hopping like a jackrabbit from one spot on the hiking trail to another. Nicky bounded behind him, matching him step for step, and John followed his daughter. Only Beth lagged behind.
Is there any reason to rush?
She shouted ahead to them, sinking to her knees to study a patch of columbines. A hike through the rainforest was a feast for the senses. Moss draped from trees that formed a canopy overhead, and parts of the trail meandered through meadows filled with wildflowers. She hated to admit it, but Beth wasn't as physically fit as John and the two kids. Stopping to admire the wildflowers had been a convenient excuse to catch her breath. She was perfectly content to ramble at her own pace. It gave her the opportunity to consider what had happened on the beach between her and John. The kiss had been for show. She was sure of it. John hadn't meant anything by it, and yet it had been wonderful. She hadn't been able to stop thinking about it. She couldn't resist the hope that it had had the same effect on him. Somehow she doubted it. It wasn't like any kiss she'd ever experienced, though. She'd felt it all the way to the tips of her toes. But then it had been a long time, and maybe that was why she'd reacted the way she had. Certainly leaping up from the sand and running to the house must have left him with serious doubts about her mental condition. This morning, neither of them had mentioned the kiss, which was just as well. The three hiking ahead of her had disappeared from sight. Reluctantly, Beth decided she'd better catch up. She followed the twisting trail and discovered Nicky sitting on a rock, waiting for her. "I was afraid you'd get lost," she said, hopping down. "You guys are in better shape than I am," Beth confessed. "You're doing all right." "I'm glad you think so." Apparently, she was in even worse shape than she'd thought, because Nicky placed her arm around her waist, as though to guide her the rest of the way. If she hadn't been so surprised by the friendly gesture, she might have commented. Overnight, it seemed, the kid's attitude had done a decided about-face. "I saw my dad kissing you." The words shocked Beth so much that her steps faltered and she nearly stumbled.
"You did?"
"Paul and I were watching."
So John had been right. And their kiss had all been for show.
"How was it?"
Nicky asked, studying her.
"How was what?"
"Dad's kiss.
I probably shouldn't ask, but he hasn't had a lot of practice lately, and, you know, if it wasn't as good as it should have been, I hope you'll give him another chance."
"I don't think this is something you and I should be discussing," Beth said, in as quelling a voice as she could muster.
"That's what Dad said when I asked him," Nicky said, sounding discouraged. "Are adults always like this?"
"Yes," Beth returned, leaving no room for doubt. "Always." Nicky's sigh was expressive.
"That's what I thought."
When they returned from the hike, Beth and Nicky went upstairs to shower. John had begun unloading the Explorer, only to discover Paul sitting in the driver's seat, pretending to drive and looking pleased with himself. He was embarrassed and started stuttering excuses in an effort to explain. That was when John had impulsively offered to give him a lesson.
"Do you think you're ready to try?"
John asked Paul, sliding into the passenger seat.
"Ready,"
Paul muttered, sounding anything but. He white-knuckled the steering wheel. "Relax."
"I don't think I can,"
Put your foot on the brake and slowly put the gear into reverse. No need to have your foot on the accelerator just yet. John was extra patient because he knew any signs of anxiety or brusqueness would intimidate the boy.
Okay, Paul said, his hand on the gear shift.
Once the vehicle had been put into reverse, he glanced at John for instructions.
Do you want me to back out of the garage? That sounds like a plan.
John hid a grin. Slowly, so slowly it was almost impossible to detect that the car was moving, Paul eased the Explorer out of the carriage house. Once he'd cleared the sides of the building, he stepped on the gas and roared backward. Almost immediately he hit the brakes, sending both of them flying forward, the seatbelts locked, halting their progress, then dashed them back against the seat. Paul forcefully expelled his breath and said,
I'm no good at this.
Hey, you're doing fine. Don't be so hard on yourself. It took three trips around the circular driveway for the boy to loosen up. By the time Beth appeared on the back porch, Paul had relaxed enough to roll down the window and shout,
Hey, Mom, watch me!
Even from a distance, John recognized the look of sheer horror that came over her when she saw her son actually driving. It was all John could do not to stare at her. Her hair was wet and curly from the shower, and she'd put on a pair of shorts and a sleeveless yellow top. He wasn't the kind of man who paid a lot of attention to clothes, but he noticed just about everything Beth wore. Her clothes weren't the only thing John noticed about Beth. She'd been on his mind day and night, almost from the moment they decided to share the house. He found himself observing little things, like the way she sliced tomatoes or set fresh-cut flowers on the table. Everything she did, everywhere she went, she added small touches of charm.
Hey, Nikki, look!
Paul yelled out the driver's window.
I'm driving!
Nikki stood next to Beth and waved excitedly. Paul eased the car into the garage with a little more finesse than he'd used to back it out. He turned off the ignition and handed the car keys to John with a triumphant smile.
Thanks.
Anytime. As they headed for the house, Nikki came down the back steps onto the lawn and, in an awkward, duck-like walk, hurried toward them. She appeared to be trying to keep her weight on her heels.
Beth and I painted our toenails.
A smile radiated from her, unlike anything John had seen in months. Years since the divorce.
Dad?
Nikki hesitated.
Are you okay? You're wearing a funny look.
You're beautiful. He meant it. Somehow he knew he had to hug her right then. Without warning, he pulled her into his arms and squeezed hard.
Dad!
She protested.
You're going psycho on me.
I love you, Nikki.
Because I painted my toenails with Beth?
No, because you're so damn beautiful. She hugged his waist tight and said in a whisper,
I look just like Mom.
No. He lifted her face so she could see into his eyes when he spoke. You look like Nikki Lynn Livingstone, my beautiful, beautiful daughter. A hesitant smile appeared on her lips.
You're acting pretty weird, Dad.
Laughing, he swung her up into his arms the way he had when she was a little girl and whirled around while she screamed with delight.
Nikki!
Paul yelled.
Are we playing Nintendo or not? Playing!
She yelled and broke out of John's embrace, but not before she'd thrown him a wide, jubilant smile. The two kids raced upstairs, and John returned to the Explorer for the picnic basket. He carried it into the kitchen and found Beth at the sink with her back to him. Any place special you want me to put this?
Anywhere's fine, she said,
but she didn't sound like herself. Beth, is everything all right? She reached for a tissue and loudly blew her nose.
It's nothing.
A part of John yearned to accept her explanation and leave it at that. But he'd been married long enough to know better.
Obviously, something's troubling you.
She shrugged.
I'm sorry. It's foolish, I know.
It's okay. Just now? When Paul was driving?
She turned toward him and wiped the tears from her cheeks.
He's growing up, John. My little boy isn't a little boy anymore.
She walked over to the breakfast nook, sat down and buried her face in her hands. Feeling completely at a loss, John opted for the practical. He brought her a box of tissues and sat down across from her. Beth smiled a couple of times, and he stretched across the table and patted her hand. He wished he knew how to comfort her. After a couple of minutes, she offered him a watery smile.
I'm sorry.
For what? Being human?
It's just that...
She grew silent, as if she regretted having said anything. Just what? Abruptly she stood, walked to the kitchen island, and leaned against it. His dad would never have driven around the driveway with Paul. Thank you for that. Her look held his, and he watched as fresh tears filled her eyes and spilled onto her cheeks. Beth? Something was going on inside her, some deep emotional pain. What is it?
My husband. I know how you felt when your wife left you. I've experienced that kind of pain, too. All the doubts, the questions. I know. Because Jim was having an affair at the time of his death.
John frowned, unable to believe that any man married to Beth would do such a thing.
I've never told anyone. Not even Mary Jane. I couldn't. Not when Paul idolized his father.
I refused to destroy his memories of Jim. So I've kept this secret to myself. She covered her mouth with her hand, obviously struggling with her pain.
I loved him. I swear I did. So very much. Deep down, I knew about her. But I chose to look the other way, for fear of what would happen if I confronted him. I didn't want to face the truth, because if I did, I'd have to make a decision, and I couldn't. I just couldn't. I didn't know what to do. His betrayal turned me into a woman I didn't know I could be. Blind and stupid and angry. So incredibly angry.
Her pain was like his own. It felt impossible not to hold her. He stood and pulled her to him. They clung to each other for long moments. When she finally looked up at him, he did what he'd promised himself he'd never do again. He took her face between his hands and kissed her. She moaned a welcome, and her lips parted as her arms crept up and around his neck. His kiss turned hungry, urgent. He didn't court or coax her lips, nor was he gentle with her. The need in him was too great to restrain. After more years than he wanted to remember, he was greedy for a woman's tenderness. Greedy for her warmth and passion. Eager to show her how she'd touched his heart. Eager to ease the ache from hers, if he could. It cost him everything to break off the kiss. His eyes remained closed, and he rubbed his lips against her temple.
I told myself I wouldn't do that.
I didn't mean to run away last night, but I was afraid.
Of me? He felt her smile.
No, of me. Of what would happen if you saw how much I enjoyed your touch.
At the sound of the kids racing down the stairs, they instantly broke apart. Beth turned away and shakily swept back her hair. John thrust his hands into his pockets. Nikki burst into the room first and stopped dead in her tracks. She stared at him and then at Beth. John was sure he looked guilty as sin. Beth, too. Paul joined Nikki, skidded to a stop, and did a double take.
We didn't interrupt anything, did we? Come on,
Paul urged in a bored voice when Nikki lingered on the path leading down to the sunken garden. The four had caught the Port Angeles ferry at an impossibly early hour that morning for a one-day trek to Victoria, British Columbia. They were now in Butchered Gardens, just outside the city.
I want to talk to you, Paul said, his voice insisting that she hurry.
Nikki glanced over her shoulder and noticed that her father and Beth had lagged behind, talking.
About what?
Your dad and my mom,
he informed her as if it should have been obvious. She tossed him a look that let him know she was beginning to find the whole thing downright tedious. It had become quite evident that their parents didn't need anyone's help to fall in love. The only problem seemed to be that neither one knew what to do about it. Nikki had never seen her dad like this, not in all the time he'd been divorced. Sure, he'd dated during the 3 years since her mother had left. Usually these were arrangements made by well-meaning friends. None had ever amounted to anything. Beth was different. Except for the past few weeks, she couldn't remember when she'd heard her father laugh. His eyes sparkled, and he seemed to have a lot more energy. He was certainly eager to do more things than he'd been in ages. It was what she wanted, what she'd hoped for. But at the same time, Nikki wished she'd been the one to bring the life back into his eyes.
"Your mom and my dad," Nikki said with a deep, heartfelt sigh, "don't need any help from the two of us."
Paul glared at her.
"What's with you?"
Nikki shrugged, unwilling to admit how she felt, especially when she didn't like these feelings. She couldn't tell Paul she was jealous of his mother.
"I like your mom," she said, and meant it.
"And your dad's great."
"You're just saying that because he lets you drive."
Paul ignored that comment.
"What do you think's going to happen with them?"
They continued walking along the pathway, urged forward by the crowd. Nikki paused on the stairway leading out of the sunken garden and looked back. She was surprised to see Beth and her dad sitting on a bench, deep in conversation. They seemed oblivious to anyone else.
"Happen?"
"Between them."
"How would I know?"
"Last weekend they were kissing, and then all week your dad went into the library after dinner, by himself."
"He had work to do,"
she said, defending her father. But she'd noticed it, too, and wondered.
"It seems to me," Paul intoned seriously, "that our parents are falling in love. The problem is, they don't know what to do next. That's what they need help with."
It was midnight before they got home from Victoria. As it was, they were fortunate to catch the last ferry to Spruce Island. By the time they arrived at the house, both Nikki and Paul were asleep in the back seat of the car. Their day had been full from beginning to end. More so, Beth believed, because she'd seen it with John. They had spent the entire week avoiding each other. But today, they couldn't seem to stop talking. It was as though they'd been friends for years. He told her about his work, and she listened, intrigued. They discussed the kids. He said he was thrilled with the change he'd seen in his daughter's attitude. Beth felt the same way. She'd grown very fond of Nikki, and the girl was beginning to trust her. John had talked more about his ex-wife, too, and how he'd come to a new willingness to forgive her and let her go. He said Beth needed to do the same thing. At Rain Shadow Lodge, John parked in the carriage house. Paul opened one heavy eyelid, and realizing the trip was over, nudged Nikki. The two children stumbled sleepily out of the car and off to bed. Beth and John sat in the dark a moment, neither of them eager to leave the warm security of the car.
"I had a wonderful time,"
Beth whispered, wanting him to know she would treasure this day. "I had a good time, too." After talking nonstop for most of the day, neither she nor John seemed inclined to speak anymore. That was fine with her. She didn't object when he placed his free arm around her shoulder. Nor did he complain when she rested her head against his. The moment was peaceful, serene. "Thank you again," John whispered. "For today, for everything, for more than I can mention. Thank you, too." She tilted her head upward, anticipating his kiss, and wasn't disappointed. His mouth settled on hers, as if he'd been thinking of nothing but tasting her lips. The hunger of his kisses stole her breath. Each kiss was longer and more intense than the previous one. Soon, Beth forgot about everything but this man who'd helped her confront the pain of Jim's betrayal. This man who'd helped her remember she was a woman with a woman's heart. She broke off the kiss and braced her forehead against his chest, drawing deep breaths into her lungs while she struggled to regain her equilibrium. "We only have a week left," he whispered. Beth didn't need that reminder. She was already well aware how little time remained. "It went so fast," she whispered. "Too fast." John's hands were in her hair, holding her against him. Silence followed. She thought about the future, and how difficult it would be to continue their relationship after this month. He would return to California, and she'd go back to St. Louis. And for a time, they'd remain in close contact. But back in the real world, everything would be different, more complicated. There would be compromises and disappointments. John tensed at the same moment she did, and she realized they'd allowed their friendship to develop too fast. Like teenagers at summer camp, they'd enjoyed a vacation romance, but they'd part, and that would be the end of it. "When are you scheduled to fly back to St. Louis?" he asked casually.
"Sunday afternoon."
"Nikki and I are catching a flight at 6.
"Ours is at 4.
"You might as well drive in with us."
"That'll work out great," she said, and leaned back against her seat.
"I guess we'd better call it a night," John suggested as he slid out of the car. He circled to her door and held it open for her.
"Thanks for a wonderful day." It astonished her that they could be lost in a kiss one moment and act like polite strangers the next. But that was what he wanted. What she wanted, too, wasn't it? A stolen kiss now and again, but nothing else, and certainly nothing more. A few days later, a soft knock sounded on the closed library door. Emotionally and mentally drained, John glanced up from his desk and pinched the bridge of his nose. The day had been exhausting, full of the unexpected, including a job offer from a Seattle-based computer company. So many decisions.
"Who is it?"
"Paul."
John got up and opened the library door. It was early, still light out, and he had a stack of printouts to read this evening if he was going to hand in his report by the end of the week.
"Do you have a couple of minutes?"
"Of course." John motioned him into the room and patiently waited for the boy to say what was on his mind.
"It's about my mom," Paul said, staring intently at John. "I'd like to know your intentions."
"My intentions?" John was taken aback by the directness of the boy's question.
"Nikki and I've been watching the two of you. We saw you kiss."
Paul said in a tone that suggested a shotgun wedding might be in order.
It didn't mean...
"You saw?" The words tumbled out of his mouth, his thoughts confused. It had been a long time since anyone had flustered him as much as this kid.
"Nikki and I think you're in love."
"Love? Paul, with all due respect, this matter is between your mother and me.
Not you, me, Nikki, and your mother. Do you love her?
John opened his mouth to automatically deny it, then stopped himself in time. He thought about the word love and realized he hadn't made it part of his vocabulary since the divorce. But he had to acknowledge that he was attracted to Beth. He couldn't be with her and not experience a deep yearning to hold her and kiss her. Yet, as strong as that attraction was, his feelings transcended the physical. In fact, his feelings for Beth had changed just about everything in his life. These past 3 weeks had shown a dramatic improvement in his relationship with Nikki, and that was due to Beth's influence on his daughter. Her influence on him, too. He'd come to understand certain aspects of his failed marriage, as well as his own shortcomings in handling the situation between Nikki and Lorraine. He credited Beth with that revelation, along with the rest. Credited her with awakening his heart and reminding him that life had a good side, too. A side he too often ignored. "I care for your mother. But as I said earlier, this isn't your business. What's between your mother and me is between your mother and me." Now, that was profound. Paul seemed to accept that. "I realize it isn't my place to be asking you these kinds of questions. I apologize for stepping over the bounds, but we don't have a lot of time. I need to be sure you won't hurt her. Not after my dad."
"Paul?"
John felt the boy's pain at the loss of his father and longed to reassure him. "Your father died in an unfortunate accident. Loving someone is risky."
"I'm not talking about my dad dying," Paul blurted.
He clenched his fists and his eyes were wet with tears.
"He was cheating on my mom! Cheating on me! It'd devastate her if she knew."
It felt as if all the oxygen had been sucked from the room. Paul knew about his father's affair.
"Don't ever tell her,"
the boy warned, his soft brown eyes near panic.
"It'd destroy her."
Mother was protecting son, and son was protecting mother.
"Are you sure she doesn't already know?"
"Positive. Why would my dad do something like that? She loved my father."
"I know she did."
"In a few years, I'll graduate from high school and be off to college. I don't want to think of my mom living alone."
"In other words, you'd like her to remarry."
"I would. Someone I like and respect. Someone I trust. Who'll make her happy, and who'll never cheat on her the way my father did."
He hesitated, gazing confidently at John.
"Someone like you, Mr. Livingstone."
"Someone like you." To think, one of the greatest compliments of his life would come from a teenage boy.
"She needs you," Paul continued. "And if you don't mind my saying so, you and Nikki need us, too. Now, what's it to be?"
Following the evening meal, Beth puttered around the kitchen, putting away leftovers. She was going to miss this kitchen, with its spaciousness and state-of-the-art conveniences. But it was far more than the kitchen she'd be thinking about in the months to come. This summer would stay in her memory. Rain Shadow Lodge, the beach, exploring the island, their day-long expeditions, and most of all, John Livingstone. He and his rebellious daughter had touched her heart.
"Hi."
Nikki sauntered into the room as though she hadn't a care in the world. She grabbed a banana, pulled out a stool at the island, and plopped herself down. "Hello there," Beth said, looking for space in the refrigerator for the bowl of leftover green salad.
Have you seen Paul lately?
No, I can't say I have.
He's talking with my dad.
Oh?
Don't you want to know what they're talking about?
Do I? The 12-year-old seemed to have all the answers.
Paul's asking my dad if he's interested in marrying you.
What?
The salad tumbled out of her hands and crashed to the floor. The ceramic bowl shattered, and lettuce, tomatoes, and other fresh vegetables colorfully decorated the tiles.
Paul's asking my dad if I heard you the first time, Beth said as she reached for a broom.
This was a joke. It had to be, and she'd fallen for it, hook, line, and sinker.
You're kidding, right?
She asked, sweeping the broken bowl and salad vegetables into the dustpan and dumping it all in the garbage.
No, I'm serious.
Nikki, this is crazy.
What would you say if my dad does decide to propose?
You love my dad, don't you?
You don't need to answer that if it embarrasses you, Nikki said, smiling benevolently. Besides, I already know you do. And you're still young enough to have babies if you wanted.
You do, don't you?
She stuffed half the banana in her mouth.
Where are Paul and your father? Beth demanded.
She had to put an end to this before it got any more out of hand.
I'd babysit,
Nikki said, her mouth full of banana.
Babysit?
My little brother or sister, but I'd rather you had a girl. I've wanted a baby sister forever.
Babies?
This had gone on long enough. Nikki, I'm honored that you'd want me as a stepmother, but... The kitchen door opened. John and her son stepped inside. Paul gave Nikki a thumbs up, and she returned the gesture.
Paul, I want to talk to you this instant, Beth insisted, then added, alone.
Sure, Mom, but first...
But first, John interrupted, I need a few minutes of your time.
Mine?
Beth asked, flattening her palm against her chest.
He nodded, then added, alone.
John, Beth said after Paul and Nikki had left the kitchen,
I can't tell you how sorry I am.
I'm not.
She couldn't believe what she was hearing.
I take it Nikki's been discussing the idea of you and me getting married.
She nodded.
She volunteered to babysit.
Babysit?
Later. You'd better tell me what Paul had to say.
Simply, that I need you in my life.
She wasn't sure how to comment,
or if she should. I don't know if Paul's given much thought to a career, but I think the boy would make a fine lawyer.
His argument was very persuasive.
You aren't actually considering, I mean...
That's up to you.
Me?
He's right. I do need you, Beth.
But marriage?
Well, that might be putting the cart before the horse.
She felt a flood of relief, replaced almost immediately by a surge of disappointment.
Naturally, it's too soon. I mean, it's only been 3 weeks, and...
Could you love me, Beth?
His eyes were tender and vulnerable, almost as if he feared her response, and at the same time hungered to know the truth. Her reply was immediate.
Yes.
She was halfway there and struggling to keep from falling head over heels for him as it was.
Could you love me?
His smile told her everything she needed to know. John held out his arms, and she walked into his embrace.
He hadn't so much as kissed her when there was a knock at the kitchen door.
Can we come in yet?
Nikki shouted from the other side.
Can they?
John asked. He'd slid his arms around her waist and smiled down at her.
What did I just agree to?
Beth asked. To love me and my daughter.
No problem.
She smiled up at him, knowing her feelings shone from her eyes. To share my life.
Marriage?
She asked again.
In time.
But I think it'd be better if we took a few months to really get to know each other first.
I agree.
Dad!
Nikki shouted.
At least tell us what's happening. We have a right to know.
Hold on, John called back.
Nikki mentioned another child, Beth said, her eyes avoiding his. John had no way of knowing how much she'd yearned for a second child. Jim hadn't been keen on the idea and found one excuse after another to put her off. Are you interested in having more children? He asked, his face intent. She nodded eagerly. John's returning grin was bright enough to rival the sun. Me too.
Where would we live?
I have a job offer in Seattle, he said to her astonishment. Should be firmed up this week. That was a possibility she hadn't even considered, living in Seattle.
Mom!
Paul's impatient voice sounded from the other side of the door.
All in good time,
she promised him.
All in good time.
Do you think I should accept it? John asked. I like the idea of moving to Seattle. Paul said,
Dad!
Nikki complained loudly.
Just how long is this going to take you? You love Beth and you know it.
John leaned his forehead against Beth's. Why do I have the feeling those two are doing their best to keep us physically frustrated? Beth threw her arms around his neck.
Kiss me first, just once.
He complied, slanting his mouth over hers in a kiss that was slow and thorough. When he lifted his head, Beth moaned in protest. She never wanted it to end. Then he was kissing her again, with a need that had grown even more intense.
They're kissing!
Nikki shouted and hurled open the kitchen door.
You've obviously agreed to something, she declared, arms akimbo.
We've agreed not to let kids meddle in our lives, John told them. He and Beth stood side by side, arms wrapped around each other's waists. Beth caught a wink between John and her son.
When's the wedding?
Nikki asked. John and Beth looked at each other. We don't know yet, Beth answered.
When will you?
Nikki wasn't giving up easily. Again, John and Beth exchanged looks. Soon, John promised.
Soon for the wedding? Or soon you'll know?
I think we could easily have two attorneys in the family, Beth whispered.
John grinned and dropped a quick kiss on her lips. Soon to both, he assured his daughter. Nikki and Paul shouted with joy and exchanged a high five.
I told you all they needed was someone to point them in the right direction, Nikki reminded him, as though the whole thing had been her idea. Where's the honeymoon taking place? Paul asked excitedly.
Beth didn't get a chance to respond. Nikki answered for her.
Rain Shadow Lodge, of course. Where else?
Beth felt a smile touch the corners of her mouth. I suggest we save the debates for later. As it is, there's plenty to decide and even more to discuss.
Why don't we all sit down and talk this out? John suggested.
That's what you said the day we arrived, Nikki remembered.
She slid into the booth and patted the empty seat beside her for her dad.
End of Side 2.
Island Time by Susan Wiggs. Read for you by Eliza Foss.
There was nothing Mitchell Baines Rutherford III hated more than missed appointments. As he watched the ferry from Ana Cortez discharge the last of its cargo, he gritted his teeth and started to pace. A low-slung corvette zoomed off, followed by a Winnebago the size of a third-world country. A station wagon crammed with squabbling kids and harried parents, followed by a convertible filled with college students. And then, nothing. Not the person Mitch had been waiting for in the blistering August sun for the past hour. The so-called expert he had hired was nowhere to be found. He stopped pacing, reached into the breast pocket of his suit coat, and grabbed his cell phone. Flipping it open, he speed-dialed his office in Seattle.
Rutherford Enterprises, said a familiar voice.
Miss Lovejoy, this Dr. Galvez person didn't show.
I'm fine, Mr. Rutherford, and how are you today? His secretary said pointedly.
He scowled, watching as a derelict Volkswagen Bug, its exhaust pipe coughing up toxic smoke, limped off the ferry, the last of the last. Salsa music blared from the open windows of the little tangerine-colored car. Mitch covered one ear with his hand so he could continue his conversation. "Sorry to be short with you," he said. "Not sorry at all. That marine biologist you sent didn't show."
"Oh, dear. I wonder what could have happened."
Miss Lovejoy sounded distressed, but Mitch knew she wasn't in the least. The Volkswagen lurched along the exit ramp, then sputtered and died just past the ticket kiosk, maybe 20 feet in front of Mitch. The driver, in a floppy sun hat and rhinestone-studded shades, banged her fists on the steering wheel and let loose with an angry monologue in rapid-fire Spanish. A pair of skinny dogs, their eyes bulging, stuck their light bulb-sized heads out the window of the car and started yapping over the tinny shriek and dull thump of the music. Mitch turned away, pressing his hand harder to his ear.
"What's that, Miss Lovejoy? I didn't hear you. I might be losing the damn signal." "I said ferry service is so unreliable in the summer."
The signal crackled, then died.
"Miss Lovejoy?"
Mitch shouted into the phone. But she was gone. Swearing, Mitch killed the power and flipped the phone shut. The woman with the Volkswagen had gotten out and lifted the rear hood, exposing a steaming and cantankerous radiator. He took a perverse comfort in seeing someone whose troubles far surpassed his own. Sure, it was irritating that his newest hire had missed the ferry, but he should be getting used to it by now. Island time, the syndrome was called. He hadn't taken the expression seriously the first couple of days, but the concept was beginning to make a sort of annoying sense. People in the San Juans live by their own inner clocks, not following any standards set by, God forbid, the business world. The tourists seemed to find the lackadaisical pace charming, but Mitch had a job to do and a limited time in which to do it. He had rented Rain Shadow Lodge for the month of August. That meant he had just 4 weeks to get going on his latest project, planning a new 40-slip marina at the waterfront of Spruce Island. Already the local planning inspector had stood him up. The marine architect had faxed some preliminary papers, and then everything had simply ground to a halt. The island sat like an emerald in the crystalline waters of a highly sensitive marine ecosystem. Before any work could be done, the entire area had to be evaluated to make sure the project wouldn't affect the local wildlife. Now, it seemed, the latest contractor had let him down as well. And the clock was ticking on a very expensive project. Mitch was about to go back to his boat, a 45-foot bayliner he'd chartered for the month, when he walked around the rear of the Volkswagen. Glancing at the stranded motorist, he did a double take. She wore a short, tight, red dress that fit like a halter on top, tied behind her slim neck. The hemline fell short enough to be declared illegal in some places, but not, luckily, in the anything-goes San Juans. High-heeled sandals enhanced the effect of long, slender legs, their polished olive hue rich and gleaming in the sunlight. When she bent over to inspect the engine, the pose made his mouth go dry. And he hadn't even seen her face yet. "Who cares what her face looks like?" his inner adolescent asked. "Need some help, miss?" he asked.
"I guess I do," she replied, one slim arm propping up the rear hood, red painted fingernails drumming on the metal.
"Freddy," the woman said sharply. "Selena, hush up, silencio!"
Surprisingly, the rodents complied, glaring at Mitch but no longer barking. "So," she said, pushing up the brim of her hat to reveal a face that more than did justice to the lush body. She took off her shades and folded them, tucking one earpiece down between the cleft of her breasts. With a frank sweep of her dark-eyed gaze, she studied him. She seemed faintly amused. Something in her expression made him wish his shirt wasn't quite so crisply tailored, his trousers not quite so perfectly creased, his shoes not quite so gleamingly polished.
"You know how to fix cars?"
"I don't know the first thing about fixing cars. We should push it out of the ferry lane, though." She lowered the hood. "Good idea." With a flash of her extravagantly gorgeous legs, she got in the driver's side and mercifully flipped off the radio.
"You push, and I'll steer."
"Great," thought Mitch, taking off his suit coat and slinging it over the passenger side window.
Head for the lot over by the waterfront, he said, gesturing. She nodded, tossing the sun hat on the seat beside her.
Okay, I'm in neutral, she called out the window.
Nice accent, he thought. Barely noticeable, just in the R's and a few elongated vowels. Setting his palms flat against the sun-heated back of the car, he pushed, feeling the resistance lessen as the small, battered Volkswagen started to roll. A moment later, she'd managed to maneuver it into a parking space at the waterfront lot.
Stay, guys,
she instructed the dogs, then got out and came around the back of the car, nodding at Mitch.
Thanks.
No problem. He tried not to stare, but she was gorgeous. Full red lips, hair dark and silky, eyes even darker, and the lashes silkier. A single teardrop of sweat trickled down between her breasts. He nearly groaned aloud. Is there someone you could call? Do you belong to an auto club? She laughed a bright staccato sound. This car's older than I am. I always figured if it broke down, I'd just walk away. Well, is there someone you could call? Yeah, I'd better. I'm late for an appointment. She turned and scanned the ferry landing just as the boat blasted its horn and pulled away from the dock. She bit her lower lip. Mitch's inner adolescent came to full alert.
Someone was supposed to meet me, but I don't see him.
He yanked his gaze from her berry bright mouth and forced his brain to kick in. Whoa! You can't be Dr. Galvez! The facts from Miss Lovejoy had said only that he was to meet R. Galvez, Ph.D., who would arrive on the afternoon ferry from Ana Cortez. Based on that, his unimaginative mind had pictured a professorial type, middle-aged, male, probably balding, and maybe a little paunchy around the middle. Her face lit with a grin as generous and bright as the summer sun. She stuck out her hand.
Dr. Rosalinda Galvez. My friends call me Rosie. You must be Mr. Rutherford.
Mitch.
Mr. Rutherford, Mitch. Is something wrong?
Me.
What?
He shook his head. Never mind. She reached into the car, randomly picking up one of the chihuahuas and stroking it absently. The dog nuzzled against her midsection.
I'm not following you.
He tried his best not to be jealous of a rat. You're not what I expected.
Oh,
she did that lip-biting thing again. It was making him nuts. Her knowing gaze took in his custom-made shirt, Armani slacks, tasseled Italian loafers.
You are.
He spread his arms, feeling the sweat run. I dressed for a business meeting. Old habits die hard.
So I guess I should get my things, right? I mean, your assistant said we'd go to Spruce Island by private boat.
That's right. He pointed out the bayliner. It's in a slip down there. I'll go get a handcart.
Great.
A few minutes later, he was still trying to get his bearings. His marine biologist was Carmen Miranda. She drove a Volkswagen Bug older than she was, complete with plastic virgin on the dashboard and fuzzy dice hanging from the rearview mirror. She had chihuahuas named after deceased Latino singers and a smile he could live on for weeks. He couldn't decide whether this was a stroke of good luck or a joke played by fate. He watched her open the front trunk of the car, noting the lyrical movement of long, sleek muscles as she moved, and decided he could put up with the chihuahuas.
Here's all my stuff, she said.
She banged the trunk shut.
Freddy, Selena, come on.
They scooted out the driver's side door. She retrieved her hat and a box of cassette tapes and CDs, then took out a small cooler of water.
For the dogs, she explained.
Lastly, she drew out a big, bulging file box.
And that? Mitch asked, taking it from her. All my personal papers.
Her gaze skated away from him.
I gave up my apartment.
This job isn't permanent. She winked.
The way my life has been going, a month is forever.
Mitch helped her roll up the car windows.
That everything?
I guess so.
Aren't you going to lock the car?
She shrugged.
Hey, if somebody can find something worth stealing in this heap, more power to him. The speakers have been blown for years.
What a strange woman, Mitch thought as he wheeled the handcart down to the boat. Possessions didn't seem to mean a thing to her. He held open the gate leading to the boat slips. Ladies first. She treated him to that dazzling smile he was already half in love with, and preceded him down the ramp, the dog skittering and dancing with joy at her feet. God, Mitch thought before he could stop himself. What did those legs look like from the Chihuahua's perspective? Mitchell Rutherford was a knight in shining armor. He couldn't know it, but he'd saved her life. Rosie didn't dare tell him, though. He had that look about him, that look that said he'd take off running the minute he realized she had no place to go, no money, no prospects, nothing beyond this one-month assignment for his firm. Free-falling without a net was nothing new to Rosie Galvez. Having grown up in a family of eight, she'd long ago learned the power of blind faith in the basic decency of the universe. But this last disaster had left her shaken. This time, she almost hadn't survived.
"Let me know when you're ready to cast off," she called to him, angling her head to see him up on the bridge. Beneath a green canvas bimini with blue sky and wheeling gulls in the background, he looked like an ad for aftershave. "I'll take care of the lines." "Thanks."
The twin engines came to life with a low-throated growl of power. She unwound the line from the cleats fore and aft, tossing them aboard and then shoving the boat, bow out, away from the dock. She hoisted herself aboard and glanced up at Mitch, who was concentrating on getting the boat out of the harbor.
"Need any more help?"
"I'm fine, thanks. We'll dock at Spruce Island in about 40 minutes. Rosie slipped off her sandals and climbed the ladder to the bridge. She stood beside Mitch and, buoyed by the warm summer breeze that blew across the water, her spirits began to rise.
"It's beautiful."
She lifted her face to the moving sea air. Mitch took a heading to the southwest. "I guess so." He didn't sound as if he meant it. She was usually pretty good at reading people, so she tried her skills on Mitchell Baines Rutherford III. Handsome, of course, but not high-maintenance handsome. He had a certain easy grace about him. She suspected, studying the pleasing breadth of his shoulders, that he'd been blessed by natural athletic fitness. The money, the looks, the aura of success would all make him wildly attractive to women. But Rosie knew, without asking, that there was no one special in his life. "You're looking at me like I'm some sort of lab specimen," he said. She laughed. "You caught me. I was just telling myself you probably don't have a wife or a girlfriend." "How did you guess?" "I'm an expert at empirical observations." "Are you interested in the position?" She refused to let her gaze waver. "Are you looking to fill it?"
"No."
"Then no."
He grinned. "Good. Glad we got that settled."
She grinned back.
"Me too."
It was better, she told herself, to get this sort of thing out in the open. They had a business arrangement, and it wouldn't do to have all this unspoken, tense interest seething around them while they worked. Because the tension was there, she acknowledged. It had been since the moment she glanced up from her dead car and seen him coming across the parking lot looking like an Esquire magazine layout. They would get along fine, she knew, as long as they both stayed in their boxes, he in his self-made millionaire world, and she in her academic with an attitude world. She knew instinctively that he'd better not find out she was in dire straits. Mitch Rutherford was definitely the type he wanted to deal with from a position of strength, not weakness. The moment he found out how needy she was, how desperate, he'd run the other way. The moment he found out how utterly lonely she was, he might break her heart. And as poor as she was, she certainly couldn't afford that. "So, you're familiar with what's involved in this sort of study, right?" he asked. She nodded. "I did a lot of field studies in graduate school. It's fun, but I take it seriously. I specialized in marine ornithology."
"What's that?"
"Birds. Especially the rare ones. Sandhill cranes and such."
"So, how'd you find out about the job?"
"The internet. Your assistant posted a notice on the UW bulletin board. The assignment looked intriguing."
a white lie. A routine environmental impact study was a total bore, consisting of predictable lab work and too much meaningless paperwork. But to an untenured professor who just found a pink slip in her mailbox, the position held the allure of a gold doubloon on the bottom of the ocean. And since the project involved staying a month at a place called Rain Shadow Lodge, doing undemanding work in an idyllic island setting, Rosie knew she'd have the chance to regroup and chart a course for the future. She'd never been much of a planner, but losing the best job she'd ever had had been a blow that left her stunned. Maybe it was a sign from the universe, a sign that said it was time to start acting like a grown-up, time to get her life in order and figure out what to do with the rest of it. Bringing the boat alongside the private dock at Rain Shadow Lodge, Mitch had to keep reminding himself that Rosie Galvez was an employee, and a temporary one at that. But everything about this well-endowed, gum-cracking woman surprised him. Though, so far, nothing had surprised him more than her reaction to the summer place. She stood on the dock while the dogs raced ahead, looking up at the old Victorian mansion as if it gave her a glimpse of heaven. He waited, her suitcase in one hand, and watched her. Something happened to her lush, extravagant beauty as she studied the place where she'd spend the next 4 weeks. A softness came over her, a vulnerability, and that vulnerability did strange and unwelcome things to Mitch. He didn't want to see it, didn't want to see the need and loneliness and stark, unhappy emotions the sight of the house seemed to evoke in her, didn't want to wonder where her need came from, and most of all, he didn't want to be the one to answer that need. It was stupid and just asking for trouble to get emotionally involved with an employee. "It's perfect," she declared. "It's like a place that time forgot. Don't you think?" "I understand that was the case with the plumbing until recently. Come on, I'll show you your room." She walked ahead of him up the long flight of open wooden steps that led from the dock to the front lawn. The flared hem of the red dress flipped enticingly in the breeze. He tried to be good, tried not to stare, but the inner adolescent, the one his mother had once said would be his downfall, made him look. He was sweating by the time he got to the top of the steps, and he'd changed his mind about getting involved with an employee, because, after all, she was perfect for him. She had signed a contract to work with him here for 1 month and not a day more. So why the hell not? It would be just like a one-night stand, only this would be a one-month stand. The one drawback was that if she was anything like a lot of women he'd known, she'd have trouble letting go at the end of the month. Mitch didn't consider himself worthy of being clung to, but women did anyway. They clung. They hung on way longer than they should, and then he had to do something that hurt them just to get them to go away. He hated hurting people, but he was willing to do it in order to keep his distance. With weary reluctance, he surrendered the brief fantasy of a wild affair with this woman. He had too much work to do. "Here, I'll get the door," he set down the suitcase. The chihuahuas were skittering around the yard, marking territory. He unlocked the door and held it open while Rosie walked inside.
"It's great! Oh, Mitch! How did you find this place?"
"Miss Lovejoy found it. She didn't tell you about it?" "Only that the lodgings and meals would be provided.
I had no idea this was what she meant by lodgings."
"I'll show you your room," he said, interested by her reaction. When he had walked into the lodge, he hadn't experienced any particular emotion other than irritation when he realized there was only one phone jack in the whole house. They walked up the stairs. He'd made a fairly random selection of a room for her, choosing one on the third story because it had an adjoining bathroom with a big fancy jacuzzi tub he couldn't imagine ever using. But when she turned to him and smiled, he was glad he'd picked this one.
"So, I guess this means you like it."
"You could say that."
She went to the window and brushed aside the curtains. The distant cascades, snow-capped even in summer, rose like white teeth across the sound.
"A beautiful view, and all this luxury? Mitch,
I couldn't ask for more. He had to train himself to quit staring at her, but it was hard when she stood there with the sunlight streaming over her, a dazzling smile on her face, and a look in her eyes that went straight to his heart.
I'll let you get settled in, he said uncomfortably. Just holler if you need anything.
I might holler anyway, she said, then laughed that easy, uncomplicated laugh. And it seemed to Mitch, as he turned away to hide a physical reaction that could drive nails, that fate was laughing at him.
Mitch woke up to the racket of salsa music and jacuzzi jets churning at full speed. Staring at the ceiling, he pictured that long, luxuriant form in the oversized tub, and his body reacted with pitiless immediacy. Wondering what further trials the day might bring, he hurried through his shower and dressed quickly, determined to get downstairs before Rosie. The house had been remodeled with a gourmet kitchen, which some of the summer residents no doubt valued, but to which Mitch was indifferent. He was indifferent, too, to the imported brass and chrome espresso machine. Some people enjoyed fussing for 5 minutes over a thimbleful of thick, bitter coffee, but Mitch settled for instant. The chihuahuas came skittering down the stairs just as he was stirring the granules of instant coffee into a cup of hot water.
Weenies, he muttered under his breath.
I heard that. Rosie appeared. Freshly bathed, her damp hair curling around her smiling face, she looked like something he used to dream about, back when he remembered how to dream.
Good morning. The dogs are bilingual, so watch what you say about them. Don't you like dogs?
Mitch lifted an eyebrow. Is that what they are? I was thinking maybe fish bait or shaved hamsters.
Very funny. I'll bet you don't even have a dog.
She bent and cuddled the yappers against her briefly, then stood.
You're up early.
It's a work day. Coffee? He held out the mug to her. She glanced at the jar of instant on the counter, then took the mug and dumped it into the sink.
Please. I have my standards.
Instant is fast. She gestured at the espresso machine.
Do you mind if I make a latte?
Go right ahead, but hurry.
You can't hurry a latte.
Fine, then take your time, he forced himself to say. She grinned at his impatient foot. He hadn't noticed he'd been tapping it.
I intend to.
We should get started before it gets too late. She found milk and a sack of Starbucks in the refrigerator.
After my coffee, I'm all yours.
He wished she hadn't put it that way. I'll show you the sight.
Proposed sight.
Whatever, I'll show it to you, and then you can tell me what the procedure is. Mitch hoped she would catch his drift. If she was like the other inspectors and officials involved in the building trades, she'd accept a generous check for her troubles and sign off on all the paperwork, declaring the project acceptable. Of course, she didn't look much like the other inspectors Mitch had worked with, but he had faith in the power of his checkbook. Working deftly, she prepared two perfect lattes, handing one to Mitch. Mitch sipped his, then looked up to see her watching him.
Well?
Well, what?
Admit it's better than instant.
It's better than instant, he glanced at his watch. But now we're running late.
Do we have an appointment?
She asked, licking a line of foamed milk from her upper lip. No, but we have a schedule to keep. Are you familiar with schedules, Rosie? She laughed.
What if I said no?
I'd believe you. But I want to make it clear that this isn't a vacation, it's work. Her smile faded a shade, and Mitch felt unpleasantly guilty. What I mean is that my investors have certain expectations for this project. The economy of this island is in trouble, and the marina could save it. I can't afford to get behind.
I understand. But one cup of coffee isn't going to make or break your project. The key is to make sure your marina isn't going to ruin what makes this island special in the first place.
She set her mug in the sink and went upstairs, returning a few minutes later with a lab kit and clipboard.
I'm ready.
They stepped out onto the porch together. Rosie took a deep breath and felt the sea air tingling in her chest.
It's wonderful here.
It's so wonderful, I can't stand it.
Mitch turned to her, frowning. What's wonderful?
This! Everything!
With a sweeping gesture of her arm, she encompassed the water, glittering like diamonds in the morning sun, the backdrop of snowy peaks in the far distance, the rise of green islands out of the placid sound.
How long have you been here?
2 days.
2 days? And you don't think it's wonderful?
I'm here to do a job, Rosie. They walked down a gravel path toward the water, then took a branch to the north and followed the shoreline. As they continued along the beach, Rosie made an informal tally of the ecosystem, noting evidence of clams, crabs, and a stunning variety of seabirds and raptors. Yet her gaze kept wandering to Mitch. There was something remote and unknowable about him, a distance. She wondered if she only imagined a certain quiet melancholy that pervaded his life, or if that was simply her overactive imagination trying to rationalize her attraction to him. And Lord, yes, she was attracted. Even with her vivid imagination, she couldn't picture him less than perfectly groomed. Every sandy blonde hair was in place. His shave was perfect, and his fingernails were neatly trimmed. So, what do you do for fun around here? She asked. Fun?
Yes, as in having a good time, doing something for the purpose of enjoyment. Clam digging, fishing.
Never done it.
Scuba diving, bicycling, picnicking.
He stuck his hands in his pockets. I didn't come here for fun, Rosie.
But if you happen to have fun while you are here, would it be the end of the world?
Of course not. I'm not a Nazi. But you know what they say about all work and no play. Maybe I like being a dull boy. She couldn't help but laugh, looking at his broad shoulders and Tom Cruise features. Nobody ever said you were dull, Jefe. They rounded a deep curve in the shoreline, coming upon a cove formed by a jagged rise of rocks. It was a place of enchantment, with a spring trickling down the stone face and creating a shifting stream across the sand, down to the water.
A salmon stream, she said, quickly noting it on the topographical map attached to her clipboard. God, it's fabulous here.
Unable to resist, she slipped off her canvas sneakers and sank her feet into the warm sand, savoring the almost orgasmic feel of it. He sent her an odd look, just a little further to the site.
I'm in no hurry,
he grinned. It didn't take you long to adjust to island time.
What's island time?
A misnomer. There is no sense of time on the island. No one's ever in a hurry around here.
Except you, she said, unable to keep a faint note of accusation from her voice.
Yes, well, someone has to get things done.
Mitch told himself he shouldn't have been surprised by Rosie's reaction to the proposed marina site. Everything about Rosie surprised him, and this was no different. Instead of getting right down to work as he'd expected her to, she spent the day in some sort of weird zen-like trance, exploring the area around the site to get a feel for the place. This was something he'd never done, never seen the point of doing. To him, places didn't have any sort of feel. They just were. And most places, this island included, could stand some improvement. The next morning, admitting that her way was a lot tastier than his, he waited for her to come down and make lattes. Bending over the table with the sunlight streaming in, they looked over maps and elevations and her pages of scribbled notes. When did you do all this? Mitch flipped through the pages covered with her scrawling handwriting in peacock blue fountain pen ink. I guess I did it on island time.
He had to smile. So she was a hard worker after all. He pushed a triplicate form toward her. That's the first document the Planning Commission needs from us. It's a bunch of questions. I've filled in where I can, but it gets technical about habitat and populations and so forth. I figure that's your department. She studied the paper for a moment, taking a thoughtful sip of her latte.
I'll have to take a lot more readings before I can complete that.
Can't you just give your best guess on some of this stuff? I mean, do we really need to document the distance to the nearest foot or record bird population density? She set down her mug and faced him squarely.
You hired me to do a job, Mitch. I intend to do it right. I won't gloss over the study.
She hesitated, biting her lip in that unconsciously sexy way of hers.
And, Mitch, I think you should know, I'll withhold my approval if it appears your marina will have a negative impact on the area.
He gritted his teeth. Over the entire course of his career, he had never let a client down, never abandoned a project. This area is dying, Rosie. People are leaving the island in droves because they can't make a living here. The marina will add a dozen jobs, and indirectly, dozens more. I didn't ask for this project. The island residents came to me.
I understand that. I don't want to stand in the way of progress, Mitch. But the islanders are the stewards of this place. I know for a fact they wouldn't want to introduce something detrimental to the environment just to drum up a few jobs. They could put a copper smelter here and employ 1,000 people.
But would it be the best thing for the island? This isn't quite the same as a copper smelter, he said peevishly.
Okay, I'm sorry. But I just want you to know, I really intend to look at this.
Fine. But he wondered if he meant it. He watched her from afar that day. He worked in the front room with its bay window, glancing up too frequently from his computer screen. She walked with a strong, purposeful stride, but she also had a way of slowing down that fascinated him. And when she sat at the water's edge at sunset, with the fine evening mist coming down over her, he noticed a curious stillness about her. She was, at her center, as tranquil as the quiet tide pools they'd found on their explorations. Just being near her had a calming effect. He discovered he was in no hurry to be somewhere, that his normally impatient nature somehow found the patience to stand back and let her do her work in her own way. You're good for me, Rosie, he thought to himself.
I want to go out in the kayak,
Rosie announced late the next morning. We both have work to do, Mitch said automatically.
Yes. In the kayak.
Going kayaking is work?
That's what I said, Jefe.
So explain to me about this kayak business.
We need to go out and explore the shores and reefs.
The sea kayak's the best way to do it,
because we'll be low in the water and we'll be so quiet. We won't disturb any of the wildlife.
He studied her for a long time. He who had been ruled all his life by discipline suddenly didn't want to have anything to do with discipline. He wanted to go kayaking with a beautiful woman, and because he wanted to go so badly, he said, no.
What do you mean, no?
I've got work to do, Rosie. Whatever needs to be done in the kayak, you'll have to do by yourself.
It's a two-man kayak.
I said I was busy. A dangerous anger flickered in her eyes. But the expected outburst expressed itself as a brilliant smile.
Fine. Then I'll wait until you're finished working.
That's not what... She was gone before he finished his protest. Muttering under his breath, he went back to what he was doing. A few minutes later, he saw something. A glint of movement from the corner of his eye. Knowing it was Rosie, he ignored the movement for as long as he could. Which amounted to about 10 seconds. He looked up from his computer and saw her walking across the yard, heading down toward the beach. His eyes nearly popped out of his head. She wore an iridescent bikini that pretty much ensured he wouldn't get another lick of work done. She sat in a chaise lounge on the dock, took out a bottle of sunscreen, and applied the gleaming polish to her long limbs, shoulders, and stomach. Watching the languid stroke of her hands over her sun-warm skin, Mitch groaned aloud. By the time she finished, he was pretty sure he was half insane. He acknowledged that he wouldn't even look at his computer as long as Rosie was wearing a bikini. He snapped his laptop shut and went down to the dock. You win, he called. We're going kayaking. She laughed, the bright sound dancing in Mitch's ears. As Rosie dipped her paddle into the placid crystalline water, a glorious feeling of well-being washed over her. Sure, she was broke, jobless, and homeless, but not at the moment. At the moment, she was paddling through paradise with a gorgeous man behind her and a pair of bald eagles soaring overhead.
God, I love this. I haven't been spending enough time in the field.
I'll have a lot more time for that now. How do you mean? Mitch asked from behind her. She gave a guilty shrug.
For the past couple of years, I've been in the classroom. It's nice to be out in the field once again.
She trailed a hand in the water as they passed over a rocky undersea wall. Anemones in rainbow colors waved lazily in the watery sunlight.
I spent the summer up here as an undergraduate, studying the reproduction habits of tube worms.
He laughed. You're kidding, right?
No, not at all. It was a great summer. My first away from my family.
So, where's your family?
Wenatchee, just over the Cascades. My parents and five brothers and sisters work in the apple industry. I turned out to be the black sheep of the family, being fascinated by marine life, of all things. My folks kept thinking I'd grow out of it, but instead I decided to make it my career.
What about your family?
You've got me beat in the family department. Haven't seen my dad since I was 9 years old. A few years after that, my mother remarried. She lives in La Jolla with a securities analyst. Between the three of them, they managed to keep me in therapy until I got tired of processing my emotions for someone who charges $375 an hour.
He spoke jokingly, but Rosie stopped paddling and twisted around to look at him.
I'm sorry, Mitch.
Don't be. It's ancient history. And after all that psychoanalysis, the answer turned out to be pretty simple.
Really?
Then I wish you'd tell me what it is.
This job, building things. It's amazing how your own problems shrink when you don't have time to think about them.
I never was that comfortable being the whining, overprivileged kid anyway.
You're serious, aren't you? You really think staying busy is the answer?
Sitting around wringing my hands and processing my emotions sure as hell wasn't.
But what happens when the work is over, Mitch? What happens then?
I don't have to worry about that. I've got enough irons in the fire to keep me hopping until I keel over.
She turned back, puzzled and vaguely saddened by him. Let's head for the President Channel, she said. A marina would increase the boating traffic there, so we should check it out.
They paddled in a comfortable rhythm. Rosie felt the wind ripple through her hair, and she put her head back, trying to take everything in. She refused to let herself be depressed by what Mitch had told her, that he owed his mental health to unceasing hard work. They glided on, their silence companionable in the way it had been from the start. She wondered why that was, why she felt so relaxed and comfortable around this man who was so different from her, who held all but the very surface of himself away from the rest of the world. In the distance, near the shore of Waldron Island, shadows flickered just beneath the surface of the water.
Is that what I think it is? Mitch said quietly.
She nodded, her chest filling up with a thrill of discovery.
Three family groups have been identified in this area. This is a pod of about 20 orcas.
A trio of dorsal fins broke the surface, and her breath caught.
Will we scare them? Mitch asked. Not if we're slow and easy.
Will they eat us? Not unless we're easier to catch than a salmon.
The kayak glided nearer, and they saw more whales, mostly females and calves at varying stages of maturity.
Wow, he said.
Look at all of them.
A large female shot out of the water, breaching only a few yards from the kayak. A tidal wave of water sprayed up, drenching them.
My God, Mitch exclaimed. Did you see that? It was the size of a bus.
Rosie watched the trail of bubbles in the whale's wake, and suddenly she felt overwhelmed.
She couldn't help it, couldn't stop herself, and even though her back was turned from Mitch, she knew she couldn't hide her darkening mood.
She laid her paddle across her lap skirt and lowered her head, wishing the month could go on forever, wishing she didn't have to go back to her real life.
Hey, what's wrong? It's just so beautiful.
The whale, you mean?
Just everything.
I agree with you, Rosie. But, hey, get a grip. It makes me nervous as hell when people get emotional. She heard him rifling around beneath his lap skirt. Then he handed her a navy blue bandana. Here, Rosie. Please don't cry. His gesture only made things worse. He muttered impatiently under his breath, and then the kayak began to glide swiftly to the nearest shore. Moments later, he beached it and climbed out, undoing Rosie's lap covering and taking her by the shoulders, helping her to stand. Better? He took the bandana from her and began awkwardly wiping her cheeks. She swallowed, but the lump in her throat was still there.
Oh, Mitch,
she said, leaning against him, feeling his arms go around her.
You probably won't believe this, but this is the best day I've had in a very long time. And it's all because of you.
Hey, you were the one who forced me to go kayaking.
But you're the reason I'm here in the first place.
She bit her lip to keep from confessing everything to him about losing her job after working so hard. But it all seems so overwhelming. She didn't know what had brought on the tears. It was the contrast, she supposed, between the glistening perfection of the day and the shabby mess her life had become. The clink of glass and the liquid gurgle in the throat of a wine bottle were the only sounds in the dining room of Rain Shadow Lodge that night. For the past 3 nights, the local gourmet shop had provided the evening meal. As he had the previous 2 nights, Mitch laid everything out on the charmingly mismatched antique dinnerware. Then he poured the wine and waited. And waited. His stomach growled, and his mind wandered. He couldn't stop thinking about Rosie. God, had he ever given in to his emotions so completely? If he had, he didn't remember. She'd simply collapsed against him as if the weight of the world pressed on her shoulders. He wasn't comfortable with big, sweeping displays of emotion. After Rosie's outburst had subsided, he'd held her awkwardly for a while, then set her away from him, saying, "Look, it's been a long day. Why don't we go back?" She'd nodded and moved away from him, and the two had paddled back in silence. A quiet tread on the stairs alerted him. He watched her come into the dining room. Barefoot, she wore the red dress and a tentative smile. "Hi there," he held out her chair. "You hungry?"
"Starved."
As he scooted in her chair for her, he had a swift, powerful urge to move his hands to her shoulders, to skim them over her golden brown skin and feel its warmth. But he didn't. It had been powerful enough holding her today, confusing enough. He was better off keeping his distance. He took a seat across from her and passed her the pasta salad.
"Thanks," she said, sampling it. "This is really good."
Just when he was starting to feel comfortable around her once again, she set down her fork, leaned across the table, and said,
"Mitch, about this afternoon."
"Don't worry about it."
"I wasn't worried. I just wanted you to know that even though I get passionate about my job, I'm very professional. You have my word on that."
"Your professionalism has never been in question," he grinned. "Your passion is just sort of a bonus." "I'm glad you feel that way. I was afraid you'd think I was being overly dramatic." "I can handle drama," he lied.
"Good. When you come from a family the size of mine, you learn how to grab center stage pretty quickly. Otherwise, you're in danger of disappearing."
He looked across the table at her, taking in her voluptuous figure, vivid coloring and gorgeous smile. "I doubt you'll ever go unnoticed, Rosie." They ate in companionable silence for a while. Then, over sips of wine, they discussed the agenda for the following day. "How about dinner out tomorrow night?" Mitch said. Rosie's trademark smile flashed, then disappeared like heat lightning.
Maybe not. I didn't bring much with me. I don't think I have anything to wear."
You can get something in town. There's a couple of shops and boutiques. I'm not really into shopping. She pushed her wine glass away. Mitch had a bad feeling about the moment. Damn it. This was why he didn't complicate his life with relationships. It was like walking on thin ice. You never knew when you were going to fall in a hole. Rosie, what is it, really? She drummed her fingers on the table. I'm having a bit of a cash flow problem. Ah, at last something Mitch could comprehend. How much of a problem? The advance on my contract went to paying off my credit cards. The bank hasn't called yet to say I'm overdrawn, but I think I'm getting close. Can't you tell based on your last statement? She burst out laughing. That's a good one. Did I say something funny? I know you're not going to like this, but I don't balance my checkbook. She said it in a rush and then held up her napkin like a shield. At first, Mitch thought she was kidding, but she wasn't, not in the least. You don't balance your checkbook? Nope. Sorry. Don't apologize to me. It's your life. But damn, Rosie, don't you feel a little irresponsible? Sometimes I do, but I always make excuses when the time comes to deal with finances. I keep telling myself one day I'll get on track, but I never do. I can help. Really, Mitch? I mean, it's asking a lot. Don't worry. After dinner, you go get your checkbook and whatever statements you have. We'll drink some port and get it all sorted out. You might need something stronger when you see the state of my banking. He laughed. How bad can it be?
This story is continued on the other side of the cassette.
You have 9 cents in this account, Mitch said an hour later. Rosie folded her hands carefully on the top of the table. He shouldn't look sexy to her just now, but perversely he did. With his hair mussed from running his hand through it, he looked so sinfully attractive that she almost forgave him for figuring out she was only worth 9 cents. I suppose, based on my record-keeping, that's about all I deserve, she said with a self-deprecating smile. So what about your other bank accounts? Are they in this shape, too? Rosie couldn't help herself. She laughed again. I don't have any other bank accounts. That's it. Very slowly, he looked up at her. Are you saying this is the only money you have in the world? Practically. I have a pension fund started with UW, but since I only taught there 2 years, it doesn't amount to much. And I can't touch it until I'm retired. Or if I do, I have to pay it all back if I ever try to get a teaching job again. Oh, she clapped her hand over her mouth. Too late. Wait a minute. Back up here. I thought you were a professor at UW. I was. That was no lie, Mitch. But you're not anymore? I was downsized. I think that's what they call it. My department just didn't get the funding to keep untenured staff. She forced a smile. So, you see, spotting Miss Lovejoy's ad was a godsend. I had to give up my apartment anyway. I don't get it. You're saying you have 9 cents in the bank, no job, and no home? You've summed it up pretty well. And don't forget the car. Oh, that's right. You've got a car that won't run. Then he startled her by adding, In spite of all that, you're just about the happiest, most well-adjusted person I've ever met. Except for the financial part. Yeah, except that. I don't get it, Rosie. Why aren't you in panic mode? Would panicking change my situation any? No, but then why should I panic? I just think panic would be in order in your situation, or at least a certain level of stress. Something will work out for me. You'll see. But suppose the day comes when you can't afford dog food. I know they don't eat much, but they have to eat something. What do you suggest I do? Ask you for a raise? You might start by deciding to care a little bit about money.
All right. So I can be as happy and well-adjusted as you, Mitch Rutherford?
What the hell's that supposed to mean?
You have all the money in the world. You can buy anything you want, go anywhere, do anything. And what do? You work. And when you're through doing that, you work some more. It's all you do, Mitch. Is that any way to live your life?
His face darkened a shade, but he didn't move. I'm building things, employing people. I wouldn't exactly say I'm wasting my life. Not in that way, no. But there's something else people need, Mitch. An inner life.
She studied him. Something about him broke her heart. He was as mesmerizing as the sun, as strong as a tree. Yet there, in the very center of him, she sensed something tender and vulnerable. Something she wanted to cherish.
Not him, reason told her. Don't fall for him. He's all wrong. He's just like every other man you've fallen for. He's just like every other man who's broken your heart.
I look at you, Mitch, she said. And I see someone who's empty. Missing something, I guess.
Then your eyesight isn't so good because I'm doing just fine.
Are you? I don't mean to insult you, but to tell you that you shouldn't keep everything all on the surface.
And how do you know I do that?
I just know. I see how smart you are about money and business, how organized, how efficient. But when you look back on the day you had today, what was the most important moment?
She held up her hand to keep him from speaking.
Don't think about your answer. Just tell me what the most important moment was.
Holding you in my arms, he blurted.
Mitch couldn't believe he'd just admitted it.
Neither, apparently, could Rosie.
Her cheeks flamed in the prettiest blush he'd ever seen. That wasn't the answer I expected.
He moved quickly to cover his gaffe. You have to admit you're a lot less scary than a killer whale.
That's a relief. It's something I worry about. Finally, you admit to worrying.
She folded her hands, twisting her fingers together.
Mitch, I'm sorry about what I said. I was way out of line. It's not my place to criticize the choices you've made.
I didn't hire you to psychoanalyze me. You're supposed to be doing environmental studies.
Well, I came here to do that.
She gestured at the stack of envelopes and papers.
Instead, I'm getting a financial makeover I didn't ask for.
So that makes us even. We've both butted in where we don't belong. Do me a favor, Rosie. Let me show you some ways to keep track of your money. It's pretty simple, and you'll feel better about everything. She eyed him skeptically.
Is that a guarantee, Mr. Rutherford?
It is, Dr. Galvez.
Fine. On one condition.
He nodded, absurdly grateful that she'd let him duck away from his comment about holding her in his arms. Name it.
You have to let me teach you something I'm good at.
Yeah? And what's that?
I'm not going to tell you. You'll just have to trust me. Now, Mr. Wizard, show me how I can get my finances in order.
For the next 2 hours, he went through her statements and registers line by line. He spent the next hour outlining a plan for her. It wouldn't make her rich, but if she stuck to it, she'd get by. She listened with the sincere absorption of a natural student, and her attention gratified him in a way that felt strange, but good.
It's a little scary, she said at last, looking at the financial plan on paper, knowing I'm going to have to be financially responsible and stay that way. I can think of worse dilemmas.
Okay, my turn to return the favor.
What favor?
Straightening out my finances.
She walked over to the stereo, flipped on the power, and fed in a CD.
And what are you going to straighten out? He asked, filled with suspicion.
Your priorities.
Rosie rolled up the area rug in the middle of the parlor. She turned to him with a huge smile and held out her hands to him. He scowled.
Meaning?
At that moment, the CD kicked in. Salsa music wailed out.
The Macarena!
Rosie yelled over the lead-heavy beat. He made a sign against evil. A nervous laugh escaped him.
Oh, no, no, you don't. I don't dance. I never dance.
Coward.
Hips swaying to the relentless tempo, she moved slowly, deliberately across the room toward him.
It's easy. Anyone can do it.
Sorry, Professor. He acted nonchalant even though he was on fire inside. Just not my cup of tequila.
But he couldn't take his eyes off her. She was mesmerizing, a vision in scarlet, a flame from the heart of a fire. Beautiful, hypnotic, shimmering, and God, burning hot.
She moved in front of him, nearly touching him. Her warmth became his warmth. He could feel the rhythm. It seemed to emanate from her, not the speakers.
Get up, Mitch, she said with laughter in her voice.
He wondered if the double entendre was intended or if his condition was that obvious. She captured both his hands in hers. Then she gave a tug.
Come on. I didn't want to work on my bank account, but I did it to humor you. And guess what? I actually learned something.
She bent forward, her incredible bosom hovering just inches from his face.
So, humor me. You just might learn something, too.
She gave one more tug on his arms. Like a snake charmed out of a basket, he stood and moved forward, pulled along by her. She led him to the middle of the parlor floor.
Okay, ready?
She seemed blithely unaware of her effect on him.
Ready as I'll ever be.
Top of the beat. Just do exactly what I do.
Half closing her eyes, Rosie put one hand, then the other, to her hips. Mitch tried to mimic her.
Good, she said. But don't just stand there like an outrigger. Feel the beat.
She reached over and turned up the bass.
Feel it?
I guess.
Okay, new move.
She showed him the next sequence, and he knew he was in the presence of a master. When it came to the Macarena, this woman was without peer. A wet dream come true. And Mitch was as stiff and awkward as G.I. Joe. After she led him through footwork and hand movements, he knew he'd never remember. She gave him a smile filled with tolerant sympathy and good-natured condescension.
So how does it feel?
She asked. Like I need a cold shower.
How does what feel? Being pushed out of your comfort zone. Being pushed somewhere you don't want to go.
I'm just so bad at this, and I don't see the point.
Aha! I rest my case.
She gave him a smile filled with secret knowledge, and then he got it. She'd felt exactly this way when he was teaching her about banking.
You're just not feeling the beat. You're too disconnected, Mitch. Take off your shoes.
He knew it was useless to protest, so he slipped off the Gucci loafers and kicked them aside. The floor vibrated under his soles, moving up through him. He felt easier, looser. Maybe there was something to this. He tried the footwork again.
You've got it!
Rosie exclaimed, her face shining with delight.
I knew you could do it. All right, now the hands.
She called out the movements and demonstrated.
Hips, hips, shoulder, shoulder.
He blew it then, just couldn't get the hand movements to coordinate with the beat.
Rosie, don't give up. You've almost got it here.
She moved in front of him, her back against his chest. The sensation of her next to him, the lavish perfume of her skin, and the smoothness of her shoulders filled him, overpowered him. She took his hands.
Keep your feet moving. See, it's good. You're feeling it.
I'm feeling something, he said through gritted teeth, but she didn't seem to hear.
Ready?
She said, gripping his hands.
We'll go through the sequence together. Hips, hips.
It was so damned easy, with her placing his hands in all the right places. So easy that he put back his head and laughed. So easy that even when she took her hands away and moved away, he was still dancing.
Jesus! Dancing! Who could have known it would feel so damned good?
Look at you, she crowed, dancing along with him.
You're wonderful!
Hey, Macarena, he sang, slightly off-key, but not caring a bit. Dancing in the middle of the room to the incessant salsa beat shouldn't give him such an absurd sense of accomplishment.
But it did. Damn, it did. You're hot, Jefe,
she said with a merry laugh and spun around. I'm not sure I'm ready for the fancy moves. He caught her as she spun back to face him. And God, he liked touching her. She was so damn soft and giving. When he heard the song winding down to its finish, he kept hold of her, backing her up against a bookcase, his hand still obeying the fading lyrics, shoulders, shoulders, hips, hips. And by the time the raucous dance ended and the next song had not yet begun, they were still touching, crushed together, breathing hard in the silent space between numbers. Desire began to rage through Rosie, and she felt herself falling, tumbling headlong in love with Mitch Rutherford. She told herself to duck beneath his arms, to make some excuse, but instead, she just stood and felt his hands slide up her arms to cup her shoulders, then slide down slowly, evocatively, massaging the back of her neck, and then her shoulder blades, and then lower. "Why, Professor," he said in a voice that was rough with teasing and desire, "I believe you're naked under this dress."
"I believe," she whispered, falling and falling and now not caring. "You're absolutely right."
After the initial exchange, he was quite deliberate and matter-of-fact in his seduction. He cradled her face with his fingertips, lifting it up so that she looked him in the eye. "I want you," he said, his tone neutral but his gaze intent.
"I know. I want you, too."
"That's what I hoped." His mouth quirked in the briefest of smiles, and then, still so slowly she nearly screamed, he bent and kissed her. It was everything she had imagined his kiss would be. No, it was more than that. She was so ready for this kiss that she moaned into his mouth and pressed forward, feeling the hardness of his chest even as she savored the softness of his mouth. He ended the kiss when she wanted it to go on forever. He lifted his mouth from hers, and she made a small sound of protest, but he only laughed, so softly. Then he amazed her by going down on one knee in front of her. He picked up her foot, held it in the palm of his hand, and bent his head, kissing the sensitive bare inner arch. Rosie steadied herself against the wall. Mitch's hand slid up her leg, smoothing along up under the hem of her dress, higher and higher, and then his lips followed, tongue flicking, touching her ankle and calf, the back of her knee, and then when he straightened up, she nearly implored him not to stop. Shouldn't they talk about this, she wondered wildly. Shouldn't they debate, plan, come to a conscious decision like the adults they were? It didn't help matters that his hand was buried under the hem of the dress. It didn't help that suddenly her legs felt as if they were made of butter. When she sank helplessly back onto the couch, she clutched at him so hard that they both wound up reclining, speechless with wanting. At the moment, any conversation or debate would be superfluous. So she didn't even try. She wound her arms around his neck, studied the dreamy glow of diffuse lamplight on his face, looked deeply into his eyes, and said, "Now." He had an endearingly awkward moment of befuddlement, as if he'd been braced for rejection, but the hesitation ended quickly, and he stood, drawing her to her feet, and led her to her bedroom. Once there, he parted the fabric of her dress, watching as it slipped down and pooled around her bare feet. He shed his clothes and took her in his arms, and she burned up with awareness of him. He had a body that was naturally athletic. She'd never been an admirer of the pumped-up look. It only meant a man spent too long sculpting his own body. Mitch was simply a creature smiled upon by fortune. Good bones and good genes. The passion that had been building in her made him look like a god to her. They fell back on the bed. He put his mouth to her ear and whispered a suggestion that made her dizzy, and he kissed her neck where his hand had been, and then traveled lower. His moth-wing kisses, his feathering touch chilling her with an eroticism that took her breath away. The endless minutes spun out into honeyed strands of desire, and when finally they joined, she felt the silky, moist fit of their bodies, and everything came bubbling up to the surface, rising and roaring. She clutched his shoulders and cried out his name and felt her own spasms trigger his. There was a moment, a breath, a heartbeat of complete and utter mutual shock,
And then he poured into her, holding and cherishing her, and then kissing her long and languidly while their bodies kissed too, sweetly, but with an edge of pleasure so sharp it bordered on pain. Rosie couldn't move, and with Mitch lying atop her, even breathing was an effort. This was usually the awkward moment, the oh God, what have I done moment, but the regrets didn't come. Instead, she savored the heavy warmth of his body collapsed on hers. When he finally moved away, she saw him discard the condom, and she was confused. She hadn't even remembered him pausing to take precautions. But she was grateful he had. It was typical of him to be discreet, considerate, and always prepared. He slipped on his boxers and twill slacks, then, with a gentle smile playing upon his lips, he sat on the side of the bed.
"You look incredibly beautiful."
Suddenly, too conscious of her nakedness, she pulled a quilt over her.
"So?" he continued, stroking his finger down a lock of her hair. "Is this the start of the painfully awkward stage?"
"That was way too wonderful for me to have regrets so soon."
"My thoughts exactly, Professor."
Mitch conceded, in the days that followed, that Rosie had a lot to teach him. He'd never seen the point of lying in the grass and watching the clouds go by until Rosie. He'd never flown a kite until Rosie. He'd never watched a spider spin a web until Rosie. She showed him how to thaw out and enjoy the moment. She convinced him to walk barefoot on the beach, to listen to crickets at twilight, to take a nap in the hammock in the middle of the day. From Rosie, he learned to roll a kayak and spot a school of fish and how to make a chain of daisies. Until Rosie, he hadn't known the meaning of free-spirited. After that first wonderful night, an idyllic time began. They did their work, yes, but it was different. A magical glow seemed to gild each moment, and a sense of euphoria filled him when he was with Rosie. He explained to her how he worked, and she showed him how to play. Seated at the scrubbed maple table, he helped her put her curriculum vitae online so she could start looking for another job. In turn, she took him swimming, fishing, cloud-watching, beach-combing. They took long, meandering cruises in the Bayliner and anchored in secluded coves where they could make love on the open deck. They talked of everything. Her unwieldy, raucous family and the scarcity of sandhill cranes. His lonely childhood and her love of romance novels. He gave up trying to understand his need for her, his hunger. He'd always had a healthy libido, had always had an eye for a beautiful woman, but it was different with Rosie. She touched him on a level no one had ever reached before. She made him laugh, made him angry sometimes, filled him with passion always. And he realized one day, when she came out of the bathhouse wearing a neon orange bikini and holding a box of snorkeling gear, that she was the first woman he'd ever met who had the power to break his heart. The days all slid together into golden ribbons of sensual moments, aglow with the secret laughter only lovers share. The nights were woven of soft black velvet, when all the world seemed to sleep, except two restless lovers who stayed wakeful deep into the heart of the night. In the middle of the third week on the island, as they sat together on the porch swing, the cellular phone rang. Mitch was startled by the sound. Almost no one on the island returned calls. Leaving Rosie rocking dreamily on the swing, he answered the phone and was a little disconcerted when the caller asked to speak to Dr. Galvez. Mitch brought the phone out to Rosie, then went inside to get some brandy for an after-dinner drink. As he heard the low murmur of her voice through the screen door, he frowned. He was starting to like this far too much. Watching sunsets, sleeping late, hearing her voice as she sat on the front porch. The thought of Seattle, the bustling downtown that used to give him such a shot of energy, now seemed bleak and gray. He poured the brandy and brought it out in two snifters. Rosie still sat on the porch swing, talking on the phone. "Thank you, Dr. Olson," she was saying, a slightly thunderstruck expression on her face. "I'll have my decision for you by the end of the month." She listened a moment longer,
then said goodbye and turned off the phone. Mitch handed her the brandy. News? She took a gulp, then another. That was a job offer. Something sank inside him. He had an instant flash of disappointment. She'd just received a dream job offer in the Florida Keys or off the Great Barrier Reef. He took a gulp of his own brandy. And? He prompted. She smiled broadly.
And you're a genius, Mr. Rutherford. Dr. Olson saw my credentials on the Internet. He wants me to work for the Puget Sound Underwater Biosphere. Huge corporate funding. I'm dazzled.
He went down on one knee in front of the swing. That's in Seattle, right?
Yes, near Pier 71.
He set down his brandy glass and picked up her bare foot in both hands. Bending, he kissed her smooth, tanned knee. So, are you going to take it? He pushed up the hem of her dress and nipped at her inner thigh. She gasped.
It sounds like a great position.
He pushed the hem higher. Since they'd become lovers, she'd developed the delightful habit of not wearing any underwear, and tonight was no exception. He teased and then tasted her, coaxing an involuntary cry from her, and he realized that he loved her like this, helpless and open to him, while at the same time completely in command of him. The swing made for an unorthodox but fascinating position, one he found wildly exciting. When he could no longer wait, he reversed their positions, sitting on the swing and lifting her up to straddle him. He entered her recklessly, swiftly. She put back her head and he kissed her throat and the valley between her breasts, and the surge of movement created by the swing brought him to a swift, searing climax. She touched her damp forehead to his and then kissed him. She tasted of brandy and the faint salt of sweat, and he wanted to hold her like this forever. Wanted to forget that their time here was coming to an end, that she had to find a job, and he had to move on to other projects.
So, she said with a shaky laugh, do you want to hear more about this job offer or not?
He stood, reaching around behind her to unzip her dress. Later, okay? She sighed, helpless, spellbindingly sexy.
Later.
Neither mentioned the fact that it was their last week at the summer place. By the time their last day of fieldwork arrived, Mitch had come to a decision. He had only known Rosie Galvez for a month, but he knew her better than anyone else on the planet, and he knew he needed her in his life. Since the phone call from the Biosphere facility, she'd gotten two other interesting offers, one in Alaska and one in San Diego. Since Mitch got a sick feeling inside each time he imagined life without Rosie, he planned to ask her to accept the Seattle offer. It was the only way he could stand to think of the future. Rosie had long since stopped trying not to fall in love with Mitch. As she loaded the kayak with gear for the final study of the area, she hummed a tune and let herself savor the heady joy of losing her heart. Yes, he was a no-nonsense businessman like the other men who disappointed her. Yes, it would probably end once they returned to the real world. She'd fallen in love with the Mitch of Rain Shadow Lodge, the Mitch who danced to the Macarena and made love to her on the porch swing and let her dog sleep on the bed with them. The Seattle Mitch was bound to be a different creature altogether. He ran a multi-million-dollar enterprise and worked 18-hour days. His secretary kept up with his mother's birthday. She resigned herself to letting this Mitch go, because being with him in Seattle would never work out. The San Diego job offer was too good to pass up anyway. But when Mitch came out of the house, tanned and smiling and ready to launch the kayak, she decided the news could wait. He looked different these past couple of weeks. He looked relaxed, happy. The summer place had worked real magic on him. Where to, Skipper? He asked good-humoredly as they paddled out into the main channel.
One last tour, maybe the far side of the cove.
And as they paddled into the cove, she started thinking more about Seattle.
Maybe, just maybe.
Hey, Rosie, what do you think that is?
Mitch pointed his paddle toward an outcropping of rock where the water was shallow. The tide pools crammed with starfish, mussels, and urchins. A group of untidy nests made of plant fibers hid in the marsh reeds at the shore.
Madre de Dios! I can't believe you found this!
Found what? What did I find?
It's the breeding place of the sandhill crane, she said. Most biologists go their whole lives without seeing them in the wild.
Cool. Are you going to take some pictures? She already had her camera out.
The world population of this animal is only 27,000, she said, fascinated. This is their nesting ground.
Damn, Rosie. Are we good or what? When they made love that night, Rosie was as ripe and eager as ever. Yet she talked less. Are you thinking about tomorrow? He asked, kissing her temple as she snuggled up against his shoulder.
Yes.
We knew the month had to end.
Uh-huh.
Rosie, I've been thinking.
Yes?
I want to ask you something. She stiffened. Stop breathing. He couldn't see her face, and suddenly wished he could. God, did she think he was about to propose marriage? It's about your job offers.
What about them?
Have you decided yet?
I'm not sure.
And for some reason, Mitch stopped there. He didn't want to push, to probe, to force something to happen that wasn't ready to happen. It just wasn't his way. And apparently it wasn't Rosie's way either, for she sighed sweetly and drifted off to sleep without saying another word.
We better hurry if we want to make the 5:25 ferry, Mitch said, loading the last of their bags onto the boat.
I'm ready, Rosie said. She looked lovely and slightly nervous as she patted her thigh, motioning for the dogs to follow her down the dock.
I hope I won't have any trouble hiring a mechanic to fix my car, she said.
It's fixed. I had it done right after you got here.
She smiled, though melancholy tinged her smile. Once the dogs were aboard, she helped him cast off. Slowly the boat pulled away from the dock. Rosie stood in the cockpit, facing back toward the house. Mitch put the engine on idle and went to her, arms circling her from behind, burying his face in her hair.
Look at the house, she said, like something out of a storybook.
Rosie, he said, turning her in his arms. Something special happened there for us. Something I don't want to end.
Mitch.
Wait, let me finish. I've been thinking about this a lot. I don't want to stop seeing you. The edges of her smile trembled.
Do you know how badly I've been wanting to hear that?
Do you know how scared I've been to say it? She smiled and touched his cheek, then dropped her hand.
I have to finish that paperwork.
I thought all the paperwork was done and we're clear to start the marina.
I have more work to do.
She ducked her head quickly. Mitch felt an odd twinge of foreboding. She was acting strange, as if she was hiding something. Rosie?
We'd better get going.
Her smile looked edgy.
You have to get to the ferry in time.
Yeah. Ferries are the only thing that are on time around here, he grinned, mounting the ladder to the bridge. I guess I don't mind so much. I could get used to island time.
She ducked into the salon without answering and picked up the thick file containing the study. Only after he pulled out into the channel did Mitch realize she hadn't given him an answer. The ferry landing at East Sound was a shock to the system. After a month in the heart of nowhere, Rosie was unprepared for the blare of horns and boomboxes, the reek of exhaust and baking pavement, the smells of fast food that greeted her as she parked the Volkswagen in the ferry line. She wished she could simply roll up the windows and disappear. But it wasn't possible. Mitch was waiting. While she'd gone to get her car and park in line, he had gone over her final assessment. By now, he'd know the truth.
Don't be a coward, Rosalinda, she said to herself, rolling down the car window so the dogs wouldn't be too hot.
Go and face the music.
Mitch stood at the dock where his yellow and white seaplane was docked. When Mitch heard her coming, he looked up, and she could tell by the expression on his face that he'd finished reading the assessment.
Nice of you to clue me in, Rosie, he said,
his voice harsh with fury.
Mitch,
I don't suppose you could have let me know sooner that you were going to recommend against building the marina.
I didn't make up my mind for sure until yesterday.
Oh, that's right. You work on island time. You do things when you feel like it.
She felt her cheeks redden. He had every right to be mad, but he was pushing her.
Mitch, in all honesty, I thought right up until yesterday that your plans to build probably wouldn't have a significant impact on the wildlife. But then, when we found the nesting ground for the sandhill crane yesterday, I knew I couldn't risk it.
Jesus, Rosie, if you ruin this project, you're gambling away the survival of the islanders. Jobs, tourist dollars.
If you destroy the wilderness, no one will want to go to the island anyway.
I don't want to destroy anything, damn it. I want to build something. You saw the plans. You know I'll be careful. We'll make every effort to minimize the impact on the environment. We'll make it work.
She forced herself to look at him, the man who owned her heart and her hopes, and felt both of them shatter. Determined not to cry, she swallowed hard and said,
Some things are just incompatible, Mitch, no matter how hard you try to make it work.
Then she turned and walked away, not looking back even though it took every ounce of strength she possessed.
It's not the end of the world, you know, Miss Lovejoy said, handing Mitch a stack of mail.
He looked up from his desk, blinking at the slanting light of the October sun. Sunshine was rare in October, but Indian summer had decided to visit Seattle. He had an urge to loosen his tie, unbutton the collar of his shirt, abandon work for the rest of the day.
What's not the end of the world? He asked distractedly, annoyed by his own thoughts.
He wasn't the same person he'd been before going to Rain Shadow Lodge. Instead of being focused on business, he experienced strange urges, like the desire to do something frivolous, to go out to lunch and never come back, or get a chihuahua puppy.
This registered letter, I had to sign for it. It's postmarked Spruce Island.
He tried to pretend he was cool and calm as he picked it up. The return address indicated that the mail was from the group of investors who'd contracted for the marina.
Great, Mitch muttered. They're probably suing me for failing to get clearance for the marina.
He felt no particular alarm at the prospect. Lately, matters of business just didn't have the importance they used to. Rosie had stolen that from him, along with his heart. He scanned the letter, and his eyes widened. I'll be damned.
What? Good news?
They've dedicated their efforts to another project that's going to net them a lot more jobs than the marina.
Really? What's that?
They're starting up kayak tours for whale watching, something they won't need a marina for. He turned over the glossy trifold brochure that accompanied the letter. The brochure featured gorgeous views of the island, including a shot of Rain Shadow Lodge. Curiously, there was a small animal in the photo. It suspiciously resembled a chihuahua.
That's funny, he said.
What?
One of the photos just looked familiar for a minute. His gaze dropped to the credit line at the bottom of the brochure. This project is funded in part by the Underwater Biosphere Foundation.
Are you feeling all right, Mr. Rutherford? His secretary asked.
Just a weird coincidence.
The new enterprise is coming about thanks to an organization that offered to hire Dr. Galvez.
That's no coincidence. She works for them.
Miss Lovejoy sent him an innocent look.
Didn't you know?
His throat went dry. No, I didn't know. I thought she took the job in San Diego.
You might want to thank her in person. If she hadn't proposed the whale-watching venture, they probably would have sued the pants off you.
Miss Lovejoy checked her watch.
If you hurry, you can catch her on the 440 ferry. She lives in a bungalow on Bainbridge Island now.
How the hell do you know all this?
If I have to explain everything, you'll miss that ferry. He was already halfway out the door. In the reception area, he paused to steal the fresh flower arrangement from Miss Lovejoy's desk and dashed out of the office. In the elevator, he took off his tie and suit coat, knowing it would be a fast hike to the ferry. The commuter ferry across the Sound from Seattle docked several blocks from his office. He ran the whole way, knowing for the first time in weeks that he was doing something right, after being so wrong about Rosie. Shoving his fare at the ticket clerk, he scanned the flow of passengers moving along the walkway toward the massive triple-decker boat. He pushed through the press of commuters. Miss Lovejoy had been wrong, he decided, standing on the bridge while the cars flowed onto the lower deck of the ferry. Rosie wasn't on the boat. Then he heard it, faintly at first, but growing sharper as it got closer. Salsa music. He looked down at the cars driving on and saw the tangerine Volkswagen lurching aboard, disappearing into the belly of the boat. His heart thudded louder than the aggressive beat of the music as he watched her park near the front of the ferry. He couldn't feel the steel stairs beneath his feet as he went down to find her. He approached the car, and Freddie and Selina started yapping madly. He went to the driver's side window, and Rosie looked up at him. She had just blown a bubble with her gum, and it rested weightlessly on her lips as she stared in shock. The dogs fell quiet, perhaps remembering him as the tolerant guy who let them sleep on the bed. Very gently, his heart rising, he took the bubble gum between his thumb and forefinger and tossed it overboard. "I was wondering," he said, bending low, "if we could find something else for you to do with your mouth." Before she could reply, he bent and kissed her, feeling her lips harden in protest, then soften in surrender as he pressed closer. When he drew away, her eyes stayed shut, and she had a rapturous expression on her face. But when she opened them, suspicion clouded her gaze. "What's this about, Mitch?" He handed her the flowers. "These are for you." "Thank you." She took the flowers. "So I guess you learned about the kayaking venture." He grinned. "Yeah, just now. It was brilliant." "So you're here because I got you out of trouble with the marina deal?"
"Yes."
"Hell no, Rosie. Then why did you wait until today? Why didn't you tell me you'd stayed in Seattle? Why didn't you tell me it mattered to you?"
Frustrated, he opened the door, pulling her out of the car and pressing her against it, not caring who was watching. "Everything about you matters to me, Rosie. I've missed you."
"You have?"
"Yes, and I'm sorry for going off like that when you rejected the project."
"You are?"
"Yes, and I love you."
"You do?"
"Yes."
He was amazed at how easy it was to say it, how true and how right it felt.
"I never thought I'd feel this way about anyone, but you changed my life, Rosie. I guess that's why I ran you off. It was different, and it scared the hell out of me."
"It did?"
"Yes, but I discovered something even scarier."
"What's that?"
"Being without you. I need you, Rosie." Tears welled in her eyes.
"Really?"
"Really."
"Oh, boy." The tears spilled over, making silvery tracks down her cheeks.
"Oh, Rosie, please don't cry."
"I told myself you were wrong for me. You're exactly the kind of guy who keeps breaking my heart."
"Not this time. This time, I'm exactly the right kind of guy. I've changed, Rosie. I don't live for work anymore. Ask anyone. I went bowling Thursday night." She smiled as the tears continued to flow.
"Ask me what my checkbook balance is. Just ask me."
"Okay. What's your checkbook balance?"
"It's $1,869.54.
He kissed her again, long and crushingly, and she swayed against him.
It felt right, perfect, just like coming home. And then he did something he'd never in his life imagined doing. Keeping hold of her hand, he sank down on one knee.
Some part of him realized that a small crowd had gathered on the passenger bridge high above them, but he didn't care.
It was time to take this step, and if the whole world saw him do it, all the better.
Marry me, Rosie. Please, marry me.
I want to. Then say yes. We don't have to live in the condo. I'll get a place on the island, anywhere you want. Yes! Her emphatic reply brought a strange thickness to his throat. This was it. The big plunge. He was so ready for it, he nearly burst. On one condition. Damn, Rosie. You name it. He meant it. The moon, the stars, the world on a silver platter. He would lie down and die for her if that's what she wanted. Anything. I want us to go away every August. Every August for the rest of our lives. I want to go with you to that summer place.
Thank you for choosing a DH Audio production. Look for other DH Audio programs at your local retailer or visit our website at www.dhaudio.com.